720 WGN, high atop Chicago in the Skyline Studio on a beautiful night, leading into what is going to be a great weather week. I think every day that it's not 60 degrees below zero with the wind chill, we're ahead of the game, right? And mathematically, it's almost impossible for that to happen. So I think we're going to be in like the 40s and
upper
50s.
Upper 40s, yeah.
Throughout the time. You hear that voice? That is the voice that you don't always hear. You hear it oftentimes.
Enough.
But usually you read it and then you hear it in your head. He's the dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine, the one and only Dave Hammond. Dave, great to have you.
Hey, Dan. Very glad to be here.
It's that time of year where there's a lot going on. You know, it's the kind of thing where you've got the shopping side of things. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the presents that are out of there. Rowan, the guys were talking about the new, what was it called? The Drinkmaster 1000 or something like that. It had some kind of crazy, made by Nespresso. Right. And so, you know, these people know how to make on demand drink devices. And it's the kind of thing that the way it was described, and we saw it in action a little bit.
I had a sip. It was decent. I mean, it was good.
Oh, Keurig. Okay. It was Keurig. I've been corrected. And that's an important correction, right? It's the pod people, right? And so you imagine your favorite drinks.
The
of course,
pod people.
Well, not in the
attack of the pod.
Yes, not in like the alien, you know, apocalyptic kind of takeover sense. But that's very cool. It's the kind of thing that if they get that down in kind of a mass setting, it could, I don't want to say take over, but certainly kind of, you know.
I think especially for more complicated drinks, also drinks that require, as so many modern-day cocktails do, multiple ingredients. And, you know, you want to buy this expensive bottle of bitters or liqueur, whatever, to make one cocktail, you know, to make one set of cocktails one night. No, just buy the kit. And then you don't have to go buy that expensive bottle of Luxardo or whatever. You have it in the kit.
Make sure that, right, you're exactly right. Instead of having to buy that entire bottle that takes you years to go through.
Yeah, if ever. Because
it's a drop here and there that goes into it. But that's a little scary on one side. I think we think of other either objects or just activities or interests that technology has gotten involved with, as mundane as they may be. But now it has left us, I think, as a people, as a civilization, as a species, defenseless. You know, where just like I used to know, and a lot of listeners through 291-7200, how to get places. You know, I used to know how to get to everybody's, you know, all your friends, all your family. You knew exactly how to get there. Now the phone does that. You used to have, as crazy as it sounds, and maybe there weren't as many numbers that you had. Maybe you had a little book, but you had most of your major numbers.
Your friends' numbers in your head.
Definitely. I mean, and so now there's only, I think my wife's number is like one of the few because it's been the same number for the last 20 years. Other than that, I'm clueless.
And I think the question is that a good thing? So then you can offload all that data that could be kept somewhere else, and you can devote your thinking to having, you know, great thoughts, to be focusing on things other than the mundane, as you say, the little mundane things of, you know, remembering your friend's phone number. Well, you know, it's in my phone. I don't have to remember it. I can use that memory space to put baseball stats in or something.
Well, you're implying that instead of, you know, trying to figure out like who's, you know, what Ashley's number is, right, her telephone number, I would be curing Ebola or something like that. Like, now I've got all the time in the world and all that extra brain space freed up. I just wonder, you know, if we're going to get to the point just like, and these are kind of crazy things, and as far as cursive writing, you said that
oh, man, you are so right on that. You know, I started using computers, word processing programs, in like 1985. So I've been using them for a long time. By the mid-90s, I had lost my ability to do cursive. I'm not exaggerating that. If I have to take like a full sentence of notes, I'm lost. Which is why I record, when I'm interviewing people, I always record, and I'll take word notes, you know, so, and time codes, like he said, interesting thing
this
about.
This is an important point to make sure
yeah,
to
right,
add
go
in.
Back to, you know, two minutes, 10 seconds, because there's something important about fish, whatever.
Well, but you had it all. You had it all in there, where now I think there's generations now that just are not even they've decided it wasn't necessary to learn all, like our kids, you know, and they're like 12 and under, 8, 11, 12. They don't know how, they've calculators. It's okay. It's not cheating. Right. It's the calculator you have with it because everybody's got one. But I don't know that they have the ability to do like long math.
I never did. So the calculator is a huge benefit to me. Mm-hmm. I can figure out bus fare and everything. You know, it's
Okay, so but you look at the Keurig drink machine. Is that going to be the future? Is it going to prevent us?
Lose the ability to make cocktails?
Will there be plaid flannel shirt bearded men with sleeve tattoos that an entire generation will be lost, or maybe they'll be off on a mountainside somewhere, the keepers of the knowledge. What do you think?
Cocktail knowledge. I have a feeling that the ability to make a cocktail is not something we're going to lose soon. And the handcrafted quality, speaking specifically about that Keurig machine. And there's something about the whole experience. And at this time of year, I'm sure many of you are experiencing it right now. Going into a bar and just sitting around with a bunch of people and having the bartender make the drink and pour it out. There's something about that ritual that I think is going to be tough for a machine to duplicate. Unless, as we were discussing, you have some screen there with a bartender's face and you can pour out your worldly problems to the robo-bartender while he's making your beverage for you.
Science, technology, advancement is many steps ahead of you, Dave. You know that they're working up like an Alexa interface that's going to be able to, it'll be that shoulder, that artificial virtual shoulder to lean on to tell your problems, and then of course they'll somehow get hacked and then they'll be up on the internet for everyone.
Oh, and the liability issues would be incredible. Your robot bartender says, well, I see your point. You have nothing to live for.
So traditions may be changing on the drink side. We have some traditions that are absolutely 100% changing coming up on January 1st, where marijuana is going to be legal here. And so those traditions of, I guess, like stashing your weed will no longer be appropriate or applicable, right? So that's going to change. Well, don't say anything, Dave, because we're going to take a break, right, Ashley? We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got Dave Hammond. He just came back from Amsterdam, which is one of those places that people think about, that they sort of revere and put on a pedestal.
The most liberal city in the world.
Yeah, so we'll talk about a little slice of that, maybe a baggie of that, coming to Chicago. It's Dane here with you, 720 WGN.
Maybe a gram of it.
James Taylor, 720. Yeah. WGN, high atop Chicago. Skyline Studio, beautiful city. Not terrible weather. And we are kind of leading into, we were talking in the last segment about some of the traditions that may be changing when it comes to the imbibing side and the drink side, as our robotic friends are kind of making things easier for us, But then again, one thing changes and becomes easier, like Netflix, right? And then, Blockbuster Video, when you're sitting there waiting to get that last copy of When Harry Met Sally, those activities go by the wayside. So as much as you may have been nostalgic about those, it's on and upward. And when it comes to Chicago, the legalization of marijuana is coming January 1st. It's been in the news, and everyone's sort of wondering. It almost feels like, Dave, if you can remember back to the whole Y2K thing, like people knew something was going to happen. Mm-hmm. People didn't know if the whole world was going to shut down or go crazy, but we're just kind of waiting to see how it affects everything.
What I've noticed lately, and I live in Oak Park, and Oak Park is going to have a dispensary. We've had a medical dispensary there. I think it's called like Seventh Generation or something like that. We've had that there for 5 or 6 years. If you had a medical card, you could go buy cannabis products. Nice. Now, I called them the other day because I was doing a piece on Alice B. Toklas brownies. I don't know if you know what those are. Alice B. Toklas was the female companion of author Gertrude Stein in Paris, and she wrote a cookbook that contained a recipe for what she called majoun, M-A-J-O-U-N. Since then, they've been called Alice B. Toklas brownies, which are like a brownie containing marijuana. She recommends, two per guest should be quite sufficient. As this is getting in the area, I called this place in Oak Park. Yes, indeed, they're going to have the full array of consumables and smokables as of the 1st. The line's going to be, I'm sure, ridiculous. What's interesting to me, though, is when I talk to people my age, and I lived through the 60s, so, it was what I'm talking about. People will go, oh yeah, I've been taking a consumable for years. My daughter sends me these gummies from San Francisco or whatever, and it's like everyone's coming out of the closet. People who hadn't, you'd think they're just, regular guys, and marijuana always has had kind of a slightly perhaps a renegade or maybe even disreputable reputation of stoners and so on. But it turns out a lot of people that I didn't know consumed marijuana or smoked it are now totally free about admitting that they do.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing, whether the stigma is one side of it, but also it's illegal, right? And so, so people would, you know, if this was something that they had built into either their leisure time or they needed it for medicinal reasons, right, they wanted to go ahead and maybe not talk about it so much. I think you're going to see two different things. I think one is going to be, like you said, Dave, that there going to be a bunch of people that don't need to hide anymore, right? And then I think you're going to see a certain amount of people that had always been maybe curious about it, but then because the stigma and the fact that it was illegal, decided they weren't going to do that. But now the door is open. And I think that regardless of what you may have heard about it, I think the fact that it's been legalized, I think is going to be a license for some people to say, like, well, it can't be that bad for you. I'll try it.
And there are so many medical benefits that are being discovered about it. Some of them are no doubt BS, you know, that it's going to cure cancer, or that you can go invisible momentarily when you smoke one of these drugs. But like sleep, I have a terrible time staying asleep. I notice, like, when I'm in one of the states where marijuana is legal, like Washington State or California, whatever, I get consumables. If I take one of those before I go to bed, I sleep through the night. Now, my wife, Carolyn, who's really? a fairly abstemious, I mean, she's a cautious person, and she knows I take Ambien when I have to, which is a heavy-duty, that's a prescribed, controlled substance. I mean, it's like something you take when you really can't sleep, and sometimes I really can't sleep. But I can sleep if I just take a fairly low dose of a cannabis, not just CBD, but a THC-containing cannabinoid consumable.
So I did not know that, but that, I think, is one way that people are going to approach it, not from the, I want to alter my reality.
Exactly.
It's whether it's, you know, it helps you sleep, it helps on the pain side, it helps in a bunch of different ways. And I think the health benefits are undeniable. And I think that's part of the reason why this has happened, is that the negative stigma had been there for so long, to where now it's just really, there's just nothing behind it, you know, and it's so helpful in so many different ways to people. And then an economic engine too. It's not necessarily that people think casinos are good. That's not necessarily why people do. I think there's some money to be made for the state.
Oh, there definitely is. And I'm glad Illinois is jumping on that bandwagon. You know, but the people who are going to be, you mentioned newbies, people who may just start their introduction to marijuana, smoking cannabis, will begin on January 1st. That happens. And so just a note here, when I was in Amsterdam a while ago this past year, I went to one of the coffee shops, coffee with a C, which means they also have cannabis there.
So no, even though I have never been to Amsterdam, in my mind, I am seeing kind of the thing that we've always either heard about or seen in movies or things like that, where it looks like a coffee shop. Everyone's sort of just, you know, it doesn't have like the medicinal clinic kind of feel you have. It's just it's a restaurant, and that's just what's on the menu.
Well, they have coffee and tea and cannabis products, and you can consume the cannabis products there or you can take them out. And I bought a joint. It was the most perfectly rolled joint I'd ever seen in my life. And so they have couches there. You can watch television. So I lit up the joint, sat on the couch, took two puffs, and realized I think that's about all I'm going to need of this one, because it's potent stuff. And so that's my word to the wise. If you just listen, stand by, children.
David's pot advice corner.
Go slowly. Don't assume you're going to have to smoke the whole joint to get, you know, have a puff or two. If this is your first time, I feel kind of like a grandpa telling the kids this.
Yeah.
But it's easy to overdose because it's much more powerful than it used to be. And this stuff is engineered for that purpose by people who know the hell what they're doing.
Yes. And so on the value side of it, and for those people that use it on a regular basis, they're going to want it to be potent and strong. And so I think that's part of it. And we'll be talking with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs a little bit later about, some of the Christmas movies that are going on and some of the new releases. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about the greatest marijuana-based movies of all time, too, because it's a misconception. You watch Cheech and Chong, you know, it's like a fire log, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, and there's just smoke everywhere, and that just isn't realistic. Or is it?
No. Harold and Kumar, high on my list.
Oh,
for those.
My gosh, those are such great movies. So the kids are asking me questions about this. So they're, you know, hey, Dad, is this going to be legal? Does that mean that it's okay to do it? I'm like, well, you know, just like anything else, there's pros and cons. And obviously you've got to, you know, you guys are, you know, you can't, I tell them that they've got to be 36 years old before they can do anything. right? Even go out on dates or anything.
That's a big dad lie.
Yeah. So you wonder how inviting and how it's going to be approached, here, because you see it, you've got that tradition in Amsterdam. When you think of Oak Park and you think of the dispensary there, and it's got sort of a clinical setting, when they have all the consumables and all the other things, are they going to put up a black light and some tie-dye, and are they going to change it up a little, make it seem more
I doubt it.
Casual?
Like a head shop from
the
60s?
Yeah.
The places I've been in like Colorado and in Amsterdam and in California, some of them look like Maserati showrooms. I mean, they're so well laid out. The light is low. The salespeople are not pushy, but very helpful. If you go, how does this compare to that? You know, this product to that? They'll tell you, and they'll have knowledge, and they seem to know what they're talking about, and they're very by the book, too. If you ask them questions, like as I made the mistake of doing in Colorado, is it possible to send this by mail back to Illinois? And they said, we can't talk about that. And if it comes up again, we're going to have to ask you to leave. It's like, whoa, okay.
So it's kind of like a don't ask, don't tell situation.
Well, it's not legal to ship it cross state borders, so they don't want to be in any way involved with that kind of conversation, telling you it's a good idea or a bad idea or anything. Which is I think it's a professional attitude for me.
Tying into some of the topics that we've talked about over the course of the last half hour, do you see, Dave, now that you've seen all aspects of it, is this gonna just be an addition to the kind of ways and avenues that people can obtain and enjoy? Or just as, you know, Blockbuster Video no longer exists because we have Netflix, is like our, you know, the guy that you call named Larry that meets you some way.
Larry may have a hard time.
Are the Larrys going out of business?
I think so. I mean, why would you buy from Larry? It's like it's so much safer to go to a store and buy it, and the prices seem competitive. I mean, I don't know what the street value is now, of course, but I think Larry may have to find alternate employment.
Well, right. So I'm sure they're going to be picking and protesting too, because once it's legal to be Larry. You know, and I don't mean it like that. So Larry's out there. There's, you know, nothing against, you can be whatever name. So, but I mean, your normal, like, neighborhood purveyor.
Dealer,
or dealer, as they're also known. It's gonna change things for them. You wonder if they'll be able to, just customer loyalty. Maybe it'll be like an artisan goods, like a farmer's market kind of thing, where, like, you know, like, you get the customer service from your local guy.
Well, if he delivers it to your door. Although, could it be long before Amazon gets into it and they start delivering it to your door along with your vitamins and deodorant?
It's already happening. They're already getting the GPS out and kind of working out the routes. Okay, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, this is something you talk about, tradition, laying the groundwork and starting the whole food hall thing, the Chicago French Market. 10 years ago, I can't believe it. We'll talk with Mary Aragone from Saigon Sisters. We'll probably talk with Leslie Cahill. We'll probably talk with Sebastian Bensadoun. Keep it here. Quick break, 720 WGN. Okay. 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio. And we can't see it from here because it's kind of underground. It's underneath the train station. But I cannot believe the passage of time, 10 years for the Chicago French Market. And at the time, it was one of those kind of groundbreaking things. People didn't necessarily know what it was going to be or how it was going to work. It was something new, something exciting. So exciting, in fact, that I was. And when Dave gets back here, he'll share his thoughts as well. But I was at the, I don't know if you'd call it a groundbreaking, but the grand opening for it. And Mayor Daley was there. Bill Curtis was there, along with a lot of the other vendors. And we're going to get a little bit of that kind of perspective as well. Somebody who's been there through so much of it, leading it from its inception to so many different kind of cool things that have gone on, maybe some challenges, and certainly a lot of triumphs as well as we get into year 10. It's Leslie Cahill, one of the driving forces. Leslie, welcome to WGN.
Hi, Dane. Thank you for having me.
Well, I don't want to say thanks for being had, because that sounds negative.
Right.
But it's,
hey, and happy holidays.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, happy holidays to you guys. And as you guys celebrate, and I know we're going to talk, we have in studio, we've got Mary Aragone from Saigon Sisters, one of the OGs, I guess you would say, of Chicago French Market, one of those kind of original places that not only serves, you know, so many great customers and fans, but also flourished, right, and had multiple locations as well. So, Mary, welcome to WGN.
Thank you.
And then Dave Hammond is here as well. You know Dave, I'm sure you probably, he was there at the at that kind of inception, that celebration initially as well. So, Leslie, talk about it. Can you, number one, can you believe it's been 10 years? And then talk a little bit about kind of how it all started and kind of where we are today.
Sure, yeah. I cannot believe it's been 10 years. Just a blink of an eye ago, we were celebrating 5 years. And at that point in time, it was a pretty uncrowded field for food halls in Chicago. But apparently we had a really hot idea because they're popping up on every corner. But we're really proud to say that we're not just surviving, we're thriving at 10 years. And I'm very happy Mary's with you tonight. She is an original vendor at Chicago French Market, and she's in a select group of really fantastic businesses that have stayed with us through everything that we've been through. And, you know, over the years, we've evolved. We started off as not a full house, and we're a pretty full house right now. We keep having new vendors onboarding. Right now, we have about 28 different vendors in the market. We still have the market concept going on, so you can buy artisan gifts on the concourse at Marché de Noël. And this week, we had a big celebration all week long for our 10th anniversary for the public. And those of you that are interested in joining in on the fun and possibly winning a trip for two to Paris, you need to go on to our website, ChicagoFrenchMarket.com/Paris10, and you can enter to win a trip for two. Tomorrow is the last day you can make that entry. Tomorrow's also a big day at the market because we have Jingle Fest going on. This is a tradition at the market where we love to have families come in. We have Santa Claus, free pictures with Santa, little toys given away to the kids, and also a balloon twister at the market.
Now, I know that.
So, lots going on.
If you look at kind of some of the different things around the world, you know, Santa is one of those guys that sort of exists in different incarnations. We've got our traditional kind of Santa guy, you know, that's sort of the American. Is it sort of a French Santa that is there tomorrow? Is it the kind of traditional regular Santa that we would know and love around the city and suburbs?
Père Noël, right?
Right. It is a traditional Santa. And, you know, we're Chicago French Market because the parent company is a French company, and the market is it invokes what you would feel if you were in a European market with multiple vendors, which is a very unique concept that is catching on here in America, of course. But when you come to the market, you're going to get food from around the world. So when you come to Chicago French Market, don't think of just French food. We do have the French lunchbox and Vanille patisserie, but it's an American Santa, and we have we actually have every continent in the world represented except for Australia and Antarctica at the market, so you can really get anything there.
Well, here's the other side of it, too, is as much as just the concept of the food hall was something where I think you could kind of put yourself in that category of pioneer, you've seen some different purveyors, some different restaurants, some different concepts come through, like the Poke was the first one. I remember interviewing them when the Aloha Poke, when they first came in, there was the first time that had been in Chicago. I know that even, you know, for whether it's some of the great chefs and some of our acclaimed culinary personalities, like Steph Izard with her bread, the artisan bread that she had with, like, the girl, that was what happening right there at Chicago French Market. So there's been not only just as the kind of the first food hall, but there's been kind of the first steps into different areas of food that have happened right there.
Oh, sure. Yeah, think about where the West Loop was 10 years ago and what a really hot culinary scene is going on in that direction. We kind of think of ourselves as the gateway to all of that, and we are like the great place to stop off during the day. The French Market closes during the week at 7:30 p.m., but if you want to come in and try some really fun food and maybe have some beer and wine and enjoy some music during the week, you come on down there and you know, enjoy great food, original chefs from Chicago. And then step out into the night.
Hi, this is David Hammond. I have a question for you. I was at the market the day it opened, or a little bit before it opened. I interviewed Mary and some others there. And some of those people I interviewed are still there to this day. Others are not. And I know people have come and gone over the years, like Pastoral, the cheese guys, mm-hmm. who I have just such tremendous respect for. And I think, like a lot of Chicagoans, I was kind of shocked to hear they were closing all their outlets, including the one at the French Market, I'm assuming. What does it take to the people that have, who are some of the people who have lasted throughout the whole 10-year period, and what do you think has given them such longevity? What's the secret of their staying power?
Well, golly, how can I tell you the secret of their staying power? Well, first off, I can tell you that we have a number of vendors that are original at the market. We have City Fresh Market. They also have a location up on Devon, and they're a full-service grocery. They have some very international products as well as staples, you know, that everybody would enjoy. Mm-hmm. There's Vanille Patisserie. They have a couple of locations in Chicago as well outside of the market. We have Mary, of course, with Saigon Sisters. Mm-hmm. There's the Frikoten with the Belgian fries.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're still there. Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they're still there mm-hmm. for sure. We have Buen Appetito, our Mexican restaurant, original vendor. We have K Kitchen, which is a Korean concept, original vendor. We have Le Fleur. Our florist has been there from the beginning. Flip Crepe has been there from the beginning. And also Loop Juice, our juice bar. And then Raw, Chicago Raw, started out at the French Market, and now they have a commercial kitchen, and they distribute their raw products through the Whole Foods and other outlets in the city, and they have another storefront, too. So we have some really strong survivors. Everybody we work with is a small business, and there's that special balance between understanding how to get that great food out to the customer, balancing your business, and making it all happen. And I don't know, you might know better than I how long restaurants last in Chicago typically. So the fact that we have so many of our vendors that are there for... Mm-hmm. Right, well, and 10 years is great. And, you know, these guys are doing great. And some people roll out of the market or go out of business for many different reasons. It was a great loss with Pastoral. Yeah. And but I will tell you, stay tuned. I promise you within about 3 months, you're going to see something really great and similar coming back to the market. So wait for that news.
From the Pastoral guys, Greg and Ken?
I can't
you
really.
You can't say.
She's got the whole, she can't divulge it. She's got to keep it close to the vest.
That's a good tease.
There's some really exciting opportunities that are developing, and we'll know more maybe in 6 weeks. We'll have some kind of an announcement, but you'll see something coming up really great in about 3 months.
You bring up a really interesting point, too, that the French Market has functioned as an incubator for businesses that need to get their footing before they go out on their own. I believe that happened, Mary, with the Saigon Sisters. You started at the market, and then you opened a brick and mortar.
Yes, definitely. I think it's really great for testing out the market without spending astronomical money in brick and mortar build out. So I have helped a couple people to open there where they're like, you know, I want to see if my concept's going to work downtown.
Yeah.
And it's a great place to start. And one of them is my friend who owns Ethiopian restaurant Demira in Uptown. So she just opened there about a year ago to see if this food is you know, a right fit for the fast casual lunch crowd.
It's great, too, because, and you mentioned, there is a pedigree there. You have seen, you know, established names and great, like you said, longevity at some of the places. It is a perfect place to go, Hendra. You're going to get some attention. You're going to get to understand whether, you know, how this is going to work and how it's going to be received. And Leslie, you brought up, you know, when you mentioned some of those, what I was and have always been impressed about is just the diversity. You know, you mentioned, it's, even though it says French Market, it's not necessarily just all about French stuff. Crepes, but you've got everything from, like you said, raw to the Belgian to the Saigon Sisters. It really does cover the entire spectrum. So before we let you go, Leslie, and we're going to let you get back to your holiday party and appreciate you jumping on, but give the information one more time how people can go there and see the very traditional Santa, get their pictures taken, and all the cool stuff that's happening tomorrow at the market.
Sure thing. Okay, Chicago French Market, we're located at 131 North Clinton. Jingle Fest goes 11 and 2 p.m. tomorrow. The market will be open from 8 a.m. until 5:30. You can come in all day long, and you can enter our contest to win a trip or two to Paris and many other prizes donated from the vendors. We have entry boxes at the market. If you can't make it in, you can go online to chicagofrenchmarket.com/Paris10 and place your entry there. I should tell everybody, too, all the way through Christmas Eve, we have a gifting market on the commuter concourse that the French Market opens on. To the address for that is 117 North Clinton. If you're a commuter out of the Ogilvie Transportation Center, we're on the lower commuter concourse. You can get some great gifts there tomorrow.
We're rocking and rolling this week. Get in there tomorrow. Get online. Enter this contest. Come see Santa. Come see us at Chicago French Market.
Ah, it's great. All right. Thanks, Leslie. Appreciate thanks, everything that you do. And congratulations on 10 years. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye, everybody. Bye, Mary.
Bye. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk at length with Mary Aragone about Saigon Sisters, the food that they have. It is there. And I think the 10 years is a testament to what they're doing, the fans that they have. And we're going to talk with her when we come back. Dave Hammond is with us as well. So keep it here. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you in the Skyline Studio High atop Chicago. And we just heard in the last segment, we're talking about some of the traditions. 10 years in the restaurant business, Dave, you'll know this. That's, I don't know if they go dog years on it, but that's a lot, right?
I think the average lifespan for a restaurant is, and Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's like 5 years or something like that.
Yeah, more like, I think, three.
I would say.
Because if you do something in 3 years and it's not making money, or you, yeah, it's like, it's better to cut it.
You have people get to like 5 years and they're like, no, we're still at a party.
It stuns me when I see restaurants close after 6 months, six mm-hmm. months. It's like, you thought you were going to be a hit right out of the box and you didn't plan on it. And it's sad, but I think you have to be ready for a year or two of a hard slug before you finally start.
It's one of the absolute toughest businesses out there, and it's kind of a unique thing. You have to be, I think, hardwired to really get in there and be able to handle the amount of work that a restaurant is. You can't just but you have people from all walks of life. You know, people that are stockbrokers or professional athletes that have sort of this romantic attachment. What do they want to do? Is they want to open their own restaurant?
It'll be a party all the time.
Yeah, it's right. It's like you want to go work at Disney World. Well, it's not the same as walking around, you know, at the park when you're working there, and it can be tough. I've been covering, you know, restaurants and the food scene for, you know, almost like 20 years. And I'll take Dave on the media side and myself included. This is like the safest place to be in the restaurant world.
right. Outside reporting.
Right. You know, then it is kind of fun. And it's always so many great stories. And this is one of the great ones, too, is Saigon Sisters and Mary Aragone. So, Mary, talk a little bit about the whole longevity of it. Did you have, you know, an idea? We had talked a little bit about in the last segment that it's kind of an easy way to get in there and kind of try out some things without that huge overhead that you have from a brick and mortar place. Was that the thought process, is get in there, see if it works?
Yes, definitely. Because when I started, I didn't have any restaurant experience. And I was one of those people that glamorized restaurant, like, oh, I have a restaurant, long line and all that stuff, and didn't know what's involved. So I went in blindly and took, like, figured that this is a low risk. Like, if it didn't work out in 1 year, I can just get out and go back to my old job or whatever. So that's what why I did it. But, you know, it turned out to be a hit in the beginning. And when you do a restaurant, you have to hit it out of the ballpark in the beginning, where you're building the brand, people want your products, you have sustainability, that it will take you to the next 2, 3, 4 years or 5 years. Because if you don't do that, and you have to work so hard to get notice and do a lot of marketing, it's not going to work in the long term. So the market actually helped with the marketing.
Yeah.
And because it was a first food hall, and people don't know what a banh mi pho is, it exposed us to a lot of people that we would never have if we were like in a corner shop in the, you know, somewhere.
Or if you were just like a standalone restaurant in the neighborhood, like a destination here, just as you had said, hey, it's not a huge investment. You can go ahead and do it. I think for the diners too that go there,
absolutely.
It's like, hey, why not try it?
It's low risk. I can spend under $5 and try some Vietnamese food. Maybe I've never had it before. Just want to check it out. I've heard it's good. I don't want to go to a restaurant and get involved in, you know, what could be, you know, $20, $30, $40 tab.
Right.
Just let me take a shot at it. And they try a banh mi and they love it, and then they go to the restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. And you have a small square footprint, so, you know, it's more controlled, so you don't have like this huge menu to deal with and a lot of food cost expense and labor. Because the bigger you are, the more costly it is.
And you mentioned the marketing side of it, is they really have done a great job and a concerted effort to try to bring attention to, you know, the group there, right? And I think it's that whole, you know, all the boats and the rising and all that stuff. Now, Dave, you had mentioned, we were talking off the air during the break about whether it's comfort food or some of those things that people come back for.
Years ago, I had done a series for New City, the magazine I still write for, about comfort food. It was called Comfort Me. And I interviewed different chefs in Chicago about They're comfort food. And I went in with preconceptions like, well, most comfort food is probably going to be high carbohydrates, like mac and cheese, with a lot of fat, just because that's kind of comforting to eat that sort of food, warm and cheesy and so on. But guys like Eric Williams over at Virtue Restaurant, I talked to him. His comfort food was beef stew. It's like, oh, I hadn't expected that, but I certainly see that that could be. And then I talked to Mary about her comfort food, and she had a comfort food unlike anybody else. It was pho.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell the story of the pho a little? It was such a great story about your dad making it and coming escaping.
Uh-huh. I mean, when we came to the States in Kentucky as a refugee. We live in this small town that has no Asian restaurant at all. But my mom has a pot of pho cooking all day long. So my friends would come over and our house smelled like soup all the time. But it's really comforting because we eat it like for lunch and, well, you know, dinner. And then sometimes before we go to bed, my dad would eat like a small, you know, pho. So that it's all the time around us, and it always reminds us of home, and it's very comforting. And I find that that is still holds true for people in Chicago because of the winter and all of that. We eat pho all day long in Asia, even though we don't have winter. But it's like comforting because it gets us going.
You don't have to be cold to need comfort.
Yeah.
I believe breakfast as well. Isn't it sometimes eaten for breakfast?
Mostly hot stuff. Because they don't like to eat cold stuff because it's a hot weather. They like, you know, it's like hot stuff get you going, and then it's better than eating cold stuff in the morning.
We've got a question, so, and let the listeners know, we're talking with Mary Arrigoni. She is the visionary founder of Saigon Sisters there at the Chicago French Market and other locations. You mentioned Kentucky, and you mentioned the pho. And, of course, Chicago, we've got this, you know, this great dining scene. You could spin the globe, and we'll find it at an elevated kind of situation here on the food side anywhere. But in Kentucky, and as a kid, you know, one of our comedy friends, Joe Coy, had mentioned, he's Filipino, that he was always kind of, he loved the food, but it was always kind of embarrassing, like, to take it to school and have to. In Kentucky, was this something that everybody embraced, or were you kind of reluctant to kind of say, like, hey, this is what we're eating, it's great?
We eat that at home. There's no restaurants that serve the food. So it's like my friend comes over. They love the egg rolls, you know, the fried egg rolls. And the pho is something different. But now that I'm in this business, I find that, oh, my gosh, people want to eat this everywhere, at the hospital, everywhere. So I actually launched a pho kit with this Soup Explorers, the startup company that is doing ready-to-made soup that is fresh, no preservatives, with meat, broth, and everything is long shelf life. So we just launched that actually at the market this Saturday. We're going to do sampling of that.
Wow.
So this way I can give this product accessible to everywhere, including Kentucky, without a restaurant.
Is that the sort of thing you could make at work? I mean, if you had...
Yeah,
it is.
It's really awesome. They figured out a way to keep the broth, like in HPP bottle, like juice, pressed juice, so it can last a long time. And then the noodles is vacuum packed, and the meats and the herbs. And then this little bowl, so you pour everything in, put it in the microwave for 2 minutes, and it's restaurant quality.
See, just like Blue Apron or any of those kind of meal kits, I mean, the opportunities for people to learn about, experience, and taste things at a decent level is just, it's mind-blowing compared to maybe how it was a few years ago. We've got to take a quick break, and then we'll be back. We've got Dave Hammond with us. We've got Mary Arrigoni. It is Dane here on 720 WGN. 720, it is Dane here with you. Allstate, not Allstate, right? That, remember, it used to be, right? Skyline Studio, high atop Chicago. Mary Arrigoni from Saigon Sisters is with us. She is going to be there front and center at the Chicago French Market. And before we let you go, we've got maybe 20 seconds. Give your website information where people can find you.
All right. Well, right now we're at the French Market, and we are also at Lake Street, 567 West Lake and Clinton in the CTA headquarters. That's where we do dinner, have an alcohol program, and a commissary for catering and delivery, that kind of stuff. And then we also open at Northwestern Memorial Hospital.
720 WGN. It is Dane here with you alongside riding shotgun with me. We've got Dave Hammond. He is the... I didn't say you're riding a horse, but apparently, right. The dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine, a bon vivant, a Renaissance man, a raconteur.
Boulevardier.
He's as at home up in the cheap seats at a bullfight as he is wearing a kilt in the Scottish Highlands or sipping cognac, you know, from a 500-year-old bottle. You name it. Dave does it. And we talked about the Chicago French Market, and although it has French in the name, you're really able to kind of taste the world. There are so many different kinds of cuisines, and that's one of the things we're blessed with here in Chicago, is that you have the ability to really enjoy any culture, food at a high level right here in Chicago. But if you do want to get out and really travel, Dave, you have done that, and we're going to talk a little bit about your travel to Mexico and the kind of foods. Because you think about it, it's sort of a double-edged sword. People love Mexican cuisine, and rightly so. It's absolutely awesome, and we've got some great places, all sorts of great taquerias, and with carnitas and everything. And then you've got Rick Bayless, who is sort of the standard bearer, right, for fine dining done in that way, right?
Flag bearer, he's our flagship. I mean, he's
So when the president of Mexico comes for a state visit, they bring Rick Bayless from Chicago to go and cook for them. He's got the Order of the Eagle. So we're really spoiled here. But then when you go to Mexico, there's all these warnings, you know, certainly with some of the upheaval and challenges they've had in some areas that are dangerous. But on the food side, right, don't drink the water. You know, you got to be careful about this. Well, right. So this is a cuisine that people love and they want to experience in kind of its indigenous form. But what would you recommend when people go?
Well, when I was in Mexico City with Mike Gebert, food editor, publisher, earlier this year, and Mike wanted to go to some fancy restaurants in Mexico City, which is cool because Mexico City is getting a reputation for having some extraordinarily good restaurants. So we went to a place called Contramar, seafood place, fantastic, a lot of fresh fish, relatively simply prepared, really good. And then we went to a place called Quintanil, which is actually Jonathan Zaragoza of the Zaragoza family recommended Quintanil. So we thought, let's go there. It was between that and Puyol, which is another, that may actually have a Michelin star. I mean, that's also a well-known place. We decided to go to Quintanil just because we could get seats there. Here's the thing. What was the best food we had there? I'll tell you what the best food we had there was. Now, Quintanil was probably about $75 to $80 each. By Chicago standards, not high. By Mexico City standards, pretty high.
Because okay? That's one of the things you think that you're getting ahead of the game a little bit is the exchange rate, that things can be of value. That's what you think when you travel.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever taken an Uber in Mexico City that cost me more than $5. I mean, I usually, when I'm in a foreign city, I like to learn how to take public transit just because that's quick and easy. During rush hour, it's usually faster. But in Mexico City, it's like, why risk getting lost on the metro? I'll spend $4 and get to wherever I want to go. Anyway, so Gebert and I are walking along the street, and we see this lady selling gorditas, which are basically like the little, kind of like pita, a little pocket. That's stuffed with cheese and meat. And so we thought, okay, what the hell? You know, we had eaten like at least 45 minutes ago. We were hungry again. And so we give, I think it costs, in Mexico, you don't ever pay until you've been served, sometimes until after you're done eating. And I think that's the way it was there. And this ended up costing like $1.25, I think, at the high end. Watching this young lady.
Wait a minute. Okay. So even if it's street food, like, let's say, so you have to kind of hang around and eat it before you pay for it?
Well, I'm sure they'd be fine if you paid it right away. I think it's a matter of etiquette. They don't feel like they should
ask. You have to be satisfied with it or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, rather than, like, at a Chicago, you go to Gene and Jude's, you're paying first, and then get out and eat your hot dog. You're not like, I'll let you know when I'm done whether I feel this was worth, you know, $2.50. So we order a gordita from this lady, and she was so joyous when I took a picture of her. She didn't know I was shooting a picture. I had my camera, a stealth picture, holding my phone up above the back of my head. She was totally focused on making this gordita that took her about 3 minutes or so to make. I mean, she was layering ingredients in and, you know, patting it down to make sure it was touching the grill in all the right places. All the time, she had this kind of angelic smile on her face. She was just so happy to be making this, and her mother was standing right behind her. And this young woman, she was probably 22, something like that, but just so involved and committed to making this simple thing so good. And it was by far, and if you ask Gebert, I'm pretty sure he'd say exactly the same thing. That was the best food we had in Mexico City. It was bought off the street. I put it above any of the food that we paid 80 times more for, and it's also a different type of food. It's kind of unfair. I mean, street food is, it sells itself on smelling good and looking good because they have to attract people walking by. So they're working to make the most delicious looking and smelling thing possible. Better taste good too, because you want return customers, even if it's a guy who just goes to work and eats it once or twice a week. So anyway, my moral of that story that I take away and that I pass along to whoever will listen, I think the best food in any country is street food, because I think it's a huge value. It reflects the culture better than any restaurant can, because restaurants frequently aim, fancy restaurants at least, aim for kind of a high level, almost like a universal food. If I go to Mexico, the last thing I want to eat is shrimp de jong and a filet mignon or something like that. It's last thing I want to eat.
Well, they may feel, because you've got international travelers in there, you never know what they're going to want.
Exactly.
So they may have like, it may be like a steakhouse kind of thing.
Exactly
where it's an apples and oranges thing, because, and maybe too, because as much as you're pleased, surprised, and really enjoyed the street food, maybe for the restaurant there, they have to do something different, right? They can't just do the same food that you can get as awesome as it is and then charge those prices or say, right, like, hey, this is right, elevated.
Right. And I think sometimes the restaurants do try to elevate street food. And it happens in Chicago all the time. A fancy restaurant will do an effort to make a high-end version of tater tots, for instance. I have never had a tater tot at a restaurant that was as good as what our Ida makes. I mean, you have to hit that right. You need to hit that right level of crappiness to satisfy.
High praise for the fine folks over at Ida. Right. Hey, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Right.
My feeling, yeah.
And I'm sure there's sort of a, like there's probably some sort of like, McDonald's has hamburger U. There's probably some sort of crappy totter U or whatever that they're, well, no, you've got to get in there. You got to do it right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, you brought up shrimp Dijon. You brought up sort of some of the ways that Chicago does things. And we've talked about it. You spin the globe. You know, the foods of the world are done well here, but also we have foods that are from here that are favorites.
Some that our listeners may never have heard of before.
Really?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we're going to do a little bit of Scooby-Doo mystery at the same time. So quick break. We'll be back with Dave Hammond. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Anyway, 720 WGN, great bumpers. Ashley is in the booth spinning the hits, right? Dave Hammond is with us as well, hey. Dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine. And when you think of the hits, there are hits that Chicago has on the food side that just keep their iconic classics, right? You know, and
Italian
some of them.
Beef. Yes. Dish pizza, Chicago right. Hot dog. Those are the big three.
312-981-7200. If people think, you can go ahead and text in. If you think of like just the handful, there's probably like 10 that people could think of, you know, whether it's like the Chicago hot dog, you know, you've got the deep dish pizza, like you mentioned, there's just a handful, but there's others that maybe aren't in the A list, right? In the team photo of first things you think about.
My friend and fellow journalist, Monica Eng, and I are researching this right now, and we've come up to, we're closing in on 30 Chicago original foods, some of which you mentioned, three of them right there. Those are definitely the big three. Although it's surprising, outside of Chicago, no one knows the Italian beef. I mean, it's virtually unknown. Chicago hot dog, though, strangely enough, I was on a ferry. I was in Hong Kong years ago with Carolyn.
that's how Dave Hammond starts a conversation.
Starts my story.
I was on a ferry in Hong Kong.
And we were going to go across Kowloon Bay to go to the other side. And there's a Chicago hot dog stand.
Right.
And I was like, okay, on the way back, I'm definitely stopped. We were in a rush to get the ferry. By the time we got back, it was night. The place was closed. And I vowed never again will I pass up eating a Chicago hot dog in a foreign country. And when I was in France a couple of weeks ago,
yeah,
I think I told you about that, walking along, there's a Chicago hot dog stand. People know the Chicago hot dog in Europe and Asia. Italian beef, I'm not so sure. And I think it's because a hot dog is pretty damn easy to make. A sausage, heated up, bun, boom, mustard, maybe ketchup in a foreign country.
In a foreign country.
Relish.
Latitude.
Onion, boom, that's easy. Italian beef, it's a little bit harder.
Well, and is it really the same thing that we think of? The words are the same, and it looks the same, or reads the same, or whatever on a menu, but is it really the same thing? We had one of our relatives taught English as a second language in China, and they have a lot of the logos of the, you know, great fast food places, whether it's Pizza Hut or Kentucky Fried Chicken or any of those kind of things. But the food is actually quite a bit different, you know, than what we would expect. We wouldn't recognize it as easily as the same things that we're used to.
If they even have it. I mean, like an Italian beef, Joe Mantegna has a Chicago food place in, I think it's Vegas, but it might be L.A. And I'm pretty sure he's using
He likes Mr. Beef.
He does like Mr. Beef.
I've brought him in here, and we've, you know, to make people comfortable, you know, and we give him, he requested Mr. Beef. And so that was
what he wanted. That's the favorite. I mean, and I trace Jay Leno to the beginning of that fad, because he ate a Mr. Beef on Johnny Carson like 30 years ago and popularized Mr. Beef, which, no offense to anybody, I kind of think of as a second-tier beef stand. I mean, I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings, but I think it's fallen over the years. But that's just my opinion, and there are all kinds of opinions about beef. For instance, I was with my buddy Lou Bank at a bar called Little Victories a week and a half ago, and we're talking about beef sandwiches, ones we like. I like L's. Lou is sold on Johnny's, or I forget exactly who.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The Italian beef you want is... The Italian beef you want to get is from X Stand, and he gave me the name, and I forgot the name. I got it in my notes. But everyone has their own feelings about what makes the best Italian beef, and I think it has a lot to do with what neighborhood you grew up in and what Italian beef was served in that place.
Well, it's one of the things that seems simple. It seems simple, you know, on its face. Oh, it's just some shaved beef, and that's, you just dip it in some, you know, that's basically what it is. And the bread is something that could handle and kind of withstand that situation. But it's really a lot more complicated than that. You know, just, I did the sort of the Italian beef summit, and it was with Al's people and the Bona people. You got right down to the origins of how it all started and the secret spices and all those kind of things.
You interviewed Chris Pacelli, right?
Yes, of course. Yes. So you've got that, and then you've got the Bona people. And even though they have reached another level of success on the business side, the way that they make the food and the beef they have is great. I actually prefer it to a lot of the smaller places. You feel like you're selling out, right? If you're, but still, it's really, really good. I think that on the beef side, it is one of those, when you look at some of the, as you have traveled quite a bit around and you have things that are beloved in their communities and in their areas, and you taste and you're like, you know, I think the beef really has the potential to be, because unlike, let's say, the Philly cheesesteak, which is kind of good, but a little much, you know, on everything that's there. You couldn't kind of build that into your regular eating regimen and survive. Where the Italian beef, you know, when you give that to someone who hasn't had it, it's, I don't want to say it's a religious experience, but it really has an impact.
It is. It seems to be immediately satisfying, and it's something that, yeah, it's Chicago only, but you can ship, I shipped servings for 8 Italian beefs to my brothers in Washington State for Christmas, so they can have it for Christmas dinner. And Bona Beef is one of the few places we'll actually send a box out. I would love to have sent Al's or Johnny's, which are two of my favorites. They just don't do it. You know, they get their beef. In fact, Al's, they cook their beef on site. Did Pacelli tell you how Al's started?
I know everything. You know, it's like this.
Oh, he did a little jail time.
He did that. The way that he did it, and Chris, he'll, obviously this is part of the interview, so we're not talking out of school here, but he was like, you know, there was a checkered past, right, to a lot of the original, you know, beef impresarios at the time. But so they had this, and then they created this, and, you know, humble beginnings, right? It was the kind of thing that was a food that you were able to feed a lot of people with. It wasn't super expensive. It used a lot of the things that weren't being used in the beef situation. And he was like, and so we stopped. I think they were like either bookmakers or something. Like
numbers.
And then we started making beefs. And that was it. And then the rest is literally like food history. And it's great to have guys like that. Those stories are just so awesome, a resource. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. how it started, you know. I don't know how you look at how Wendy's started. You know, you got a guy, right? You know, or Ray Kroc with McDonald's or how that. But the Chicago Italian Beef Stories is a great one.
It is. It is. Yeah. And Pacelli is a great guy to talk to. He's the nephew of El Ferrari, who started El's Beef. So he, and he's still working. When I called him the other day, he's making a delivery somewhere. It's he's in his 60s. He loves making the beefs, and he makes a damn good beef. El's is right up there with one of my favorites.
He's living it, right? He is really, honestly, he's like the physical embodiment of Al's Beef, right? He's the personification.
I've actually never met him in person. I've talked to him on the phone, but never. But I plan to go out to his place and see him. So anyway, yeah, Italian beef, hot dog, deep dish pizza. Those are the three dishes that most people associate with Chicago food. And when tourists come to Chicago, that's what they want to eat. And God bless them. You know, that's good. I hope they enjoy it. But there are dozens of other foods, smaller scale foods, that are maybe produced at only two or three places. I refer, for instance, to the mother-in-law, which is, are you familiar with that, Dane?
Not really.
Oh, well, then perhaps your listeners aren't either. Mother-in-law is, and this is served principally at a place called Fat Johnny's. I think it's like 79th Street. And
Ruben-esque Johnny's.
Fat Johnny's still alive and selling this stuff. A mother-in-law is a hot dog bun with a Chicago corn roll tamale dropped into it. And Anthony Bourdain, incidentally, had one of these when he did his No Reservations in Chicago. He went to eat one. A corn roll tamale, incidentally, if you don't know, I mean, everybody knows what a tamale is now. It's usually like in a corn husk made by hand by Mexican grannies in the back room. ideally, that's how they're made. A Chicago corn roll tamale is like a Supreme or Tom Tom tamale. If you're ever at an Italian beef stand, you'll see on the menu, a lot of them are serving tamales. What you will get is like tamale in a little plastic or paper bag. It's been steaming usually for days because no one orders this stuff. And it's like a thin cornmeal roll with a magenta core that's supposed to be meat, but I think it's just dyed cornmeal. So they take that, this is a mother-in-law, take it, cornmeal, corn roll, tamale, put it in the bun, put chili over the top, and then dress it like a hot dog, like with a pickle spear, tomatoes, maybe cucumber, perhaps even celery salt. And that's called a mother-in-law. And the joke is, it also gives you heartburn. That's what Johnny says. I don't even
who would question Fat Johnny? So we're going to talk about some of these delicacies, these indigenous things that happen here on the food side in Chicago throughout the course of the program with Dave Hammond. We're going to take a break right now, and then when we come back, we actually are going to have something on the sweeter side. We're going to have Paula Haney, owner of Who's Your Mama Pie. So stay tuned for that quick break. 720 WGN.
Did somebody say pie? It's a wonderful day for pie. You can ask all the birds in the sky.
720 WGN. It is Dane here with you in the Skyline studio. We've got Dave Hammond, dining and drinking editor for New City, to my right. And to my left, we've got Paula Haney. She's the owner of Who's Your Mama Pie here in Chicago. One of, and I'm not saying that anything that people don't know, is one of our favorite, kind of almost, and it's been like 10 years, right? So you guys have existed. You guys have reached, and I don't know if you feel it, but legendary status right at this point, don't you think?
I feel it today. It was a long day in the kitchen. But yeah, it's awesome. It's been so much fun.
Well, here's the thing too, is Dave, you know, not everybody has a job that, you know, makes people happy, that people look at and they smile. You know, if you're, let's say you're like a garbage guy or even construction worker or even a radio host, right? It's not always happy. But the making pies is something that I think is kind of a universally festive and appreciated things. No one is punished with pies, right?
Not if you get one in the face.
Right. Three Stooges. Right. There's a long lineage of punishment, of pie-related
punishment. Right.
Punishment. So let's talk a little bit about Who's Your Mama. For those people, the uninitiated, who may not be aware of it, talk a little bit about how it all started and where you are today.
Sure. I grew up baking pie. I am from Indiana, as the name implies. And pie was just the big dessert at our house for every special occasion. I just loved baking, and I was lucky enough to move to Chicago, and I worked in some amazing restaurants and had an amazing time making all kinds of fancy food. But at the end of the day, you know, I'd come home exhausted, and I just wanted a slice of pie that was just so comforting and special to me. And I looked around for it, and at the time, nobody was doing just pie. So eventually, I just decided, well, you know, maybe if I'm looking for pie, somebody else out there is looking for pie, too.
Right, the pie. They did like the match.com for pies, right? And 27 levels of compatibility. Before we came in here, Jeff Carlin, one of the producers for Rokan Show, he was talking about his time working at Baker Square, right?
Oh, wow.
You know, which is kind of, you know, mass produced kind of a chain pies and things like that. And people, I mean, I think people appreciate that to a certain extent. Is there a kind of pie, like apple pie? It doesn't get any more American than that. It's right in the song, right? Are there certain, how many pies are there that are kind of the favorites, that are maybe like the bulk of what it is that you have? Of course, you dabble in obscure and delicious things as well, but what are the main ones people look for?
When we got ready to start the company, we made a list of what we thought were the six iconic pies that we had to master. Let's see, and now let's see if I can remember them. They were apple, maple pecan, banana cream, chocolate cream, coconut cream. Oh my gosh, I'm going to forget one. And I think it was blueberry because it was summertime.
Yeah.
And I felt like, I mean, apple definitely. If you cannot make apple pie, sure, you cannot open a pie company. Those are huge. Rhubarb is my favorite. So we added that early on.
I'm surprised so many creams were in there. That seems like, did you find that that ended up selling as well as you thought?
Yeah, people love the cream pies. When we opened our second shop in Evanston, it's also a dollop coffee shop. So we open very early in the morning. And my plan was, well, we'll open 6:30. We'll have some muffins. We'll have some coffee. We'll put the pies out at 10. People came in at 6:30 and they wanted chocolate cream pie. And they were angry.
You don't want to, you don't want a pie wanting mob,
right,
out in front of it. Well, you mentioned those six and you're thinking, can we think of them all? And certainly that team photo and apple and, you know, but then I'm thinking as I'm like, okay, other, like peach pie has got to be very popular.
Yeah.
Key lime.
Yeah. Oh, key
right?
lime is
my
huge.
Favorite.
Yes. Yeah.
For my birthday, we don't have a birthday cake. We have a key lime pie for me.
Yes.
Because that's what I want.
And we can classify people's personalities based on the kind of pie they're
eating.
Oh, like
yeah? Yep.
There's like a pie zodiac kind of thing?
Kind of, yeah.
What do you read into a key lime pie?
Be gentle.
Am I sorry I asked?
No, not at all. Key lime people are usually pretty fun.
So far, so good.
The thing that we laugh about, though, is, you know, we make 10 to 20 kinds of pie every day, but it's not always the same kind of pie. And key lime people will come in and say, do you have key lime? And we'll say, no, we've got these 17 other fabulous kinds of pie. And they'll be like, oh, bye. And they'll turn around and
wow.
leave.
Wow. Very doctrinaire.
Yes.
Or what's rigid. Rigid, I guess.
Well,
you don't want to criticize
your
customers.
You know what you want.
Think of yourself as criticizing me.
Yes.
Well, the heart wants what it wants,
yes.
right?
So there you go.
Yes, that's right.
I think that some of these, some pies are, you know, you look at pumpkin pie, right? It's seasonal. People really only want it maybe during the fall. It's not something there's probably a huge demand for, but apple pies are wanted like year round. But on the kind of artisanal side and the thought process of things where you want to maybe be seasonal if you can, are there some where you just have to compromise and say, well, we just have to have these pies because people want them? Or do you try to say like, well, this part of the year we're going to have this and maybe this will, you know.
We do bake seasonally, and we're very committed to it. We get most of our produce from local farmers. Apple pie is the one that we made an exception for, though, because we did feel like there was going to be a riot if we opened our doors.
See,
and
mob, angry mob, riot. This is.
But it is
where's,
fun.
Who's, where's your, where are you located?
Could we talk a little about mincemeat pie?
Oh, sure,
I'm curious about that, because that's maybe. It's a little unusual. Everyone knows what an apple is, or a peach, or a blueberry. But mincemeat, it's kind of like, meat.
The marketing company in the pie lobby really kind of dropped the ball on that one.
That did not pass the focus group at all. I love mincemeat pie.
I do, too.
And we make it every year, and we put it on our holiday menu, but mostly because I love it. And I think there are about 20 people in Chicago who show up every year and get mincemeat pie. And I actually have to make it personally by myself for both shops because the other bakers revolted.
They revolted because they didn't want to.
It's a very, very long process, and we don't sell that many.
Well, I think this is a teachable moment, right? It's one of the things that people have heard of. Everyone has heard of it, but it's kind of a big ball of mystery, right?
Yep, people, so what is it?
Explain it.
I can explain that. First of all, most of the time anymore, it does not have meat in it.
Did it ever?
Like, it did. It evolved from the Middle Ages. It was soldiers coming back from the Crusades. And they were in the Middle East, and they came back with recipes for meat pies with spices and sometimes They would add some alcohol to preserve the meat, and they brought that back to England. And over the years, it just had less and less meat and became sweeter and sweeter. So what it is today, ours has apples, lots of dried fruit, lots of spices, very wintry spices, clove and mace and ginger and cinnamon, and a fair amount of booze. It has rum and brandy in it.
It sounds wonderful.
I wonder what kind would have had originally when it came back with the Crusaders, lamb in it? Or it wouldn't have been pork, I wouldn't suppose.
I know in England they put beef in it, but I don't know what it would have, what it started out as.
Hmm. Yeah. I love savory pies, too. So, I mean, beef.
Yes, we make those as well, and I think it is confusing for people. And they're like, okay, so that meat pie is not actually meat. I'm like, nope.
The one that's called meat.
The one that's called meat is not meat.
Well, this is good to know, though, because the way that you describe it, and maybe it's the kind of thing, like the Asian carp. If they, there was, I did an interview in a show about them trying to rename that into something more palatable, right? And I don't know that they ever succeeded, and maybe we're enjoying it.
Happy
I don't know.
Good time fish.
Like the delicious fish. I don't even
is that
know.
What I had for dinner?
So maybe some rebranding could happen there as well. So how does it work for Hoosier Mama? Because you guys are, you know, you're committed to you know, local, you're committed to seasonal and artisan and all that. Do people order the pies and then you make them? Or do you try to anticipate, you know, the demand and have some ready? How does it work?
Oh, yeah, we have pies in the shop every day. We do take special orders with 48 hours notice so we can be sure we have the ingredients on hand. But as I said, we have 10 to 20 kinds of pie every day. We always have apple. We always have chocolate cream. And the rest of them are kind of dictated by the seasons and what the bakers feel like making.
What's the key to a chocolate? Because I love a good chocolate cream pie. But is there a special way to have it, you know, when it's a Hoosier Mama chocolate cream pie? It's better than the, you know, the Maurice Linnell.
Good quality chocolate.
You know, yeah, that's exactly it.
Is that it? Okay.
Yeah. And cream, heavy cream.
I have a question for you about a savory pie, like a chicken pot pie.
Okay.
Do you sell those?
We do, yeah.
I order those almost every time I see them on the menu at restaurants. And what I get many times, and I'm sure you've seen it, it's like chicken stew with a plate of pastry dropped on the top.
Yeah, that's not a pie.
It is not a pie. I mean, it doesn't have a bottom crust. It doesn't really have a top crust. It just has a piece of pastry, ideally pastry, dropped on top. And it seems like a cheat to me. And I understand why restaurants have to do it, because it takes a long time, perhaps, to heat up a pie.
It takes a long time to make a pie.
And so it's easier just to make the stew and then buy a frozen pastry plate and just drop it on top of there. I think the pie lobby should protest that.
We've got a lot of work for the pie lobby already.
I was only joking, really. I'm not sure that there is a pie lobby, but if there is, I think on the to-do list for the pie lobby is the rhubarb pie. You mentioned it's one of your absolute favorites. I grew up with it. It is, I don't know if it's an acquired taste or if it's just you have to kind of make it, but it's one that's kind of misunderstood but it's really great when it's done well. And it's the kind of thing that I don't know that you can get it everywhere. It's kind of almost homemade, right? I mean, that's usually where you see it.
I feel like I'm the champion of all the underdog pies. Everybody should try rhubarb pie. They should try buttermilk pie. They should try mincemeat pie. There's so many wonderful pies that were very, very homemade that have been forgotten.
You know, rhubarb is, in my mind, inextricably linked with pie. And rhubarb is actually called, if you look it up in the dictionary, one of its variant names is pie plant.
Yep.
Because rhubarb is so frequently turned into pie or jam or something like that, because you can't really, like, dice it up, steam it, and put butter, and that's it. I mean, it's extraordinarily sour. It'll just pucker your mouth to the point of where you can't breathe. So you need to doctor it somewhat. I don't know if there is such a thing as a sweet rhubarb plant, is
no,
there?
No, rhubarb. Rhubarb is always sour.
It's always going to be really sour and slightly bitter.
Yeah, we would just, like, coat it in sugar. Is that the way?
Yep, that's it.
But it's great. Okay, so just to let the listeners know, we are talking with Paula Haney from Hoosier Mama Pie. And not only does she make great pies and have them available, we'll hear what you can get for the holiday season and what you can enjoy when you go there and visit them in person. But also she's paying it forward on the advice and insight side with the book. So when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the book with Paula and find out what kind of secrets she's given out. I would say keep them close to the vest. I would say have all sorts of things in there that kind of lead people. I don't want to in the wrong direction, but not always in the best direction.
That is not the way of pie. but that's
just me. All right, quick break. We'll be back right after this. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you. Skyline Studio High atop Chicago. And in studio with us, of course, we have Dave Hammond, dining and drinking editor for New City. And we've got Paula Haney, owner of Hoosier Mama Pie. And she did not come in empty handed, right? She always travels.
Always
is it half pie will travel? Do you always carry them with you? Or when you people come in and they see you, do they ask where the pie is? Do you feel obligated?
It gets me invited back.
Yeah. So, and you would know her, obviously, and know the pies from all the great stuff they do here in Chicago, but also a lot of attention, you know, Bon Appetit and Food Network. And so what was that like? Because you mentioned when you first started the place and you were like, you had this passion to do this, but you weren't necessarily sure exactly how well it'd be received. And it has from the get-go. Have you been surprised at all the, I don't want to say, like, yeah, accolades, the attention that you've gotten?
It's been really wonderful and gratifying, because it's, you know, it's scary to go out on your own. Our shop was 750 square feet. You're standing in this little tiny shop. I think the first day we were open, you know, Chicago Avenue and Ashland Avenue 10 years ago, the first two people that came in the door were looking for the live chicken place down the street. So
now, did you try to corral them in? Like, well, before you go, you've got to try this rhubarb pie.
You know, I didn't, but I should have.
What goes well with chicken? Pie!
But no, it's been really great. And Chicago's been so supportive. We started out just at Green City Market, and all of our customers showed up the day we opened and stood in line and were there to support us. So, yeah, it's really been wonderful.
You sell to some restaurants, too, I believe.
We do a few restaurants. We do Whiskey Thief in Evanston. We do Dollop Coffee Shops, Metropolis Coffee Shops. We don't do a lot of wholesale, but we like to collaborate.
Then the high praise is extended. I mean, I'm going to be in for John Williams on Monday, and a longtime friend of mine is Duff Goldman from Charm City Cakes. And back in, I don't know, I've been like 2012 or 13 when he was in town, we were doing some stuff with him, and we were talking about Hoosier Mama Pie.
He came and baked pie with us and dressed up like Elvis. It was great.
I mean, come on. Okay, so that's the next thing you do. When you become a celebrity, as you have, Paula Haney, you know that you can't sign pies. You know, in sports, right, Dave, and you're not a huge sports fan, but you understand you have footballs and bats and jerseys and things like that. But signing of a pie just doesn't seem like a great way to go ahead and preserve the moment of fandom. So you wrote a book. So
yes.
It's almost like whether you see yourself on a billboard or you have your own action figure. I think in the culinary world, when you have your own book, it's another testament to, I think, success. So talk a little bit about the book.
Yeah, we were really lucky we were approached to write the book. I'm a huge fan of cookbooks, and I grew up reading my mom's 1938 Betty Crocker cookbook with lots of wonderful pictures and stories. And so that's kind of where I wanted to go. So we have a lot of stories. We talk about our farmers. I probably talked too much about eating pie growing up, lots of pictures, and I wanted it to be not just a cookbook with pretty pictures, but like an instruction manual, like a very practical, you open this book, there are pictures, there's step by step, you're going to know how to make pie when you're done. And it's really great. I get phone calls from people saying that they've used the book. And
is there any common mistake that people make when they're preparing a pie? I mean, some like real easy amateur rookie error that you might advise people to be careful.
Sure, yeah. The first thing I would say is when you're making the pie dough, don't overmix it. We recommend making it in a food processor, which is really fast and easy, but don't let the dough come together in the food processor. It should still be crumbly, and then you can knead it together by hand. It's so easy to overwork pie dough.
And what happens when you do overwork it? I mean, what's the result? Toughness?
It gets super tough, and it's going to be very hard to roll out. It's not going to be. I think we've all had that experience, either trying to roll out a super tough pie shell or eating a pie that...
It must have took a while for anyone to get used to taking it out of the food processor and knowing how much to knead it, and then when to back off.
Yeah,
and
it looks wrong. And it's actually a very fast process. I think there's a tendency in baking, people want to do more. And a lot of times you really just need to back off and do as little as possible to the ingredients.
Baking is hard. Baking can be very hard.
Yeah, it can be kind of
so scientific.
Yeah.
Which is why my wife does it. I don't do it. It's like too precise. I need something
sloppy.
You
do have to measure.
Yeah, right. Math.
What's with math? The book is the Who's Your Mama Book of Pie. And so you mentioned that, you know, there's some great stories in there. People love to hear the backstory, how things happen, some kind of like pie history and lore.
Yes.
Now, but you want to have some things in there too. Did you, as far as like which ones to include, you can't include all of them. And there were there things you said, oh, I think this will be really great. People will enjoy. Or did you have some things that you didn't want, that maybe like we were talking about, a little complicated and you don't want to send people off on a some kind of a difficult journey?
There were some things that my biggest pet peeve is when I read a cookbook and I feel like the author's dumbed it down and not explained things. I was teased extensively for writing 3 paragraphs on how to make a pastry cone, which you use to pipe chocolate onto things. So I was pulled back on that. And
you were pulled back, so you had to like shorten up that section?
I did. In the end, I got it in the book, but it's pretty funny. And then the thing where I really could have just written forever is I ended up researching old pie companies in Chicago in the teens and 20s and 30s, and it was fascinating. There were so many, and it was such a huge part of city life.
Fasano, I remember.
Yeah, Fasano. And now, of course, I can't think of any others, but I will in a moment.
Is that the kind of thing where, you know, there's certain foods that maybe have, that still exist and that we still have, but they were just maybe more present and just prevalent back in a different time? Is pie like that, where it was maybe included in, you know, most people's desserts? You know, it was something that people could
absolutely
make. And
it really, you know, it was very popular when people moved from the country to the city. And then it became sort of unfashionable because it wasn't sophisticated. Mm. And now it's had its, you know, it's coming back.
That's it. You know, that fashionability of baked goods. I was talking to a chef last week about the lack of cookies in restaurants, which are one of my favorite desserts.
Yeah.
And they don't. This was at Laventino, the chef there, Matt, I'm forgetting his last name. But I asked, why do you think it? And he does have great biscotti after dinner. I was like, this is fantastic. You never get cookies in restaurants. Why do you think that is? And the chef said, it's not, they're probably not fancy enough, that people expect something a little more extravagant for dessert, something with lots of chocolate and color. And a cookie is just too humble.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and they probably think it's too simple, but really, getting a good cookie is not easy, just like a good pie.
Especially if you want to eat one like me, and they're just not around.
Before we go to the break, and then we'll come back, and we'll give the website and all that information, are there any things that you guys are doing like right now, you know, as far as like maybe some specials for the holidays or things that people can get in on?
We have a new pie. It's a speculoos pie. Ursula, our baker at the Chicago shop, our kitchen manager, is of Dutch heritage, and she has come up with a traditional Dutch spice blend.
Mm.
It's coriander and cinnamon and all kinds of wonderful spices, and we've made a cream pie out of that, and that's on our holiday
menu.
Wow.
Is that a traditional Dutch pie then?
No, there was no. She just took the flavors and the spices and turned it into pie.
What do you call it again?
Speculoos. And if anybody Dutch is listening, I apologize.
Yeah, no, it's something that you that
is it
you
a say. Bad word.
No. I just, the pronunciation
nice one,
is probably not right.
All right,
oh, gosh, I hope not.
She is giving people the pies that they know, love, and want, and then guiding them and kind of inspiring them to try new things in pies as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get the website and everything. It's Dane here, 720 WGN. 720 WGN. We are back here with the visionary founder and owner of Who's Your Mama Pie, the one and only Paula Haney. And Paula, before we let you go, give information. We've talked about the amazing story, the history, the pies. Where can people like see you in person, then website to get more information?
Sure. Our website is www.whosyourmamapie.com. We have 2 shops, 1618 West Chicago Avenue in Chicago, and 749 Chicago Avenue in Evanston.
You know, is there anything that you guys do on social media? There's nothing better than a great pie picture, right, on Instagram.
We are on Instagram and Twitter.
And those handles are?
At HMPC.
HMPC. This is really great. And so last thing, so for you personally, you have all the pies at your kind of just at your disposal right there. What's your favorite kind of pie? I know you mentioned you like the mincemeat pie.
Yes.
But I think that's more of like a charity like. Is there, what's your favorite?
Mean.
My all-time favorite is rhubarb, but
really?
Yeah, I love it. Unfortunately, I won't have it again until May, but
mm-hmm. That is so seasonal, yeah. The rhubarb pie.
I like banana cream. I eat that a lot.
Nothing wrong with that. And, of course, Dave is a key lime pie man. So 720 WGN, it is Dane here with you in the Skyline studio. And it is that time of year. Dave Hammond is with us as well. It's that time of year, Dave, when it's the gift-giving time, right? You're thinking of trying to either surprise that certain special someone or that loved one with the thing that they want or didn't know they needed, or maybe that redundant sweater or tie or whatever it is that people want. Also, too, is you know, your daughter's grown up, right? Mm-hmm. And so you hadn't have to live through the elf on a shelf phenomenon.
Oh, actually, I did introduce that to our household.
Oh, no.
But I misunderstood the tradition, and I thought what the elf did was play tricks on people. So what I did was use it as an opportunity to prank my kids and blame it on the elf. That's how I perversely continued the tradition of elf on a shelf.
It's so much work. Once you enter in and bring that into your household and your psyche, we said that the elf is retired. And went to spend more time with his family. And everybody seemed okay with that. The kids were all right with it. So our particular elf is out of business.
Isn't the idea that the elf is like a snitch, that he tells on you if you do things or something like that?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Well, I just think of it as an obligated, you know, kind of... It's almost like the Tooth Fairy thing, if you can remember back to that. Like, hey, did you put it out? Did you do the tooth... I don't know. I don't want to, like, let any cats out of any bags here, right? So anyway, I see it as that. But you know what? They sell a lot of things at Wanamaker's. I don't know that there is an elf shelf section there if they've got that. But they do have, if you are into barbecue, if you are into grilling, if you are into any of those things, and not only just the equipment that makes it great, but all of the tools and then all of the spices and rubs, not only the stuff that you can find at the grocery store. This is the real deal stuff that the teams use, that the teams make, that they create, that they win with. So much stuff. And that's just part of what Wanamaker's does. But that's certainly my interest area. On the line, we've got, he is the department manager for the barbecue and grilling department, Steve Cross, over there at Wanamaker's. Steve, welcome to WGN.
Hey, Dane, what's going on? How's everybody doing today?
Everybody is okay. This is the time of year. I think Chicago, at all times, is a barbecue and grilling place, so there could be huge snowdrifts. There's no season for it. But this is the time when the gift-giving side kind of maybe is even more prevalent. Has it been busy there? Have you got people coming in trying to get that certain special someone, that certain special something smoky or grilling-related?
It's starting to pick up now. I think, you know, as you get to the weekend before, you start to get a little more people shopping for that person and that gift. You know, we have sold a few of the bigger items because they don't have anywhere to hide it. So they look to have it delivered right before the holiday. You know, they're buying their special person a grill of some kind.
So what are the popular things now? Because you always have your Weber kettle. You know, that's the home team here. We've got them, you know, located right in the area, and everybody's got to have one of those or a new one of those. And, of course, they've got their new the smoke fire, you know, their new kind of foray into the pellet world. Has the interest in that been as hot as people in the industry have anticipated?
It has been. A lot of it has to do, I mean, Weber has really done a good job at building up the pent-up anxiety as far as wanting to see it. So I'm getting a lot of inquiries as to the cost and how it functions, but, you know, Weber's doing the old, you know, keep it a secret until, you know, mid-January is when they're actually going to get it out to the stores. You know, everybody's wanting to see it and touch it, and they're doing a good job of pushing that.
Dave, what do you have at home? Do you have
I have a regular Weber kettle and a Weber Smoky Mountain that we use usually for special occasions, because if I'm going to smoke something, it's going to be a lot of meat. And if I'm going to make a lot of meat, I need to have some people there, because I'm not going to do it just for my wife and I. So we use that less frequently, but it always turns out great. It's so easy to smoke meat. And people love it. It's like a special occasion thing. I mean, the smoke adds no calorie flavor to meat. Steve, right?
Yeah.
Steve, I have a question for you. For Thanksgiving, we smoked a turkey. And as we did last year, too, we didn't do it years before, we got a turkey from Whole Foods and had them spatchcock it, which for those at home that may not be familiar with it, spatchcocking is basically breaking the bird at the spine and kind of spreading it out, or cutting it in half so you have two half birds, half bird, and then it cooks more evenly. Steve, have you ever cooked an entire bird with any success? Smoked an entire bird with any success?
I have, and it's not as hard as it seems. The spatchcocking way has become the much more popular way to do it, because you get that nice even heat on it, mm-hmm. so you get a nice more even cook to it. But yeah, I have. I've been pretty successful at doing it. It's just the patience and just keeping an eye on the temperature and making sure you don't overcook it.
And would you say overcooking is probably the main challenge of using a full bird to smoke?
Correct. Yeah. And if you're putting it in there, if you're not doing it the spatchcocking way, if you're doing it the traditional way, that's probably what happens most, is that you overcook it and dry it out.
Is there any reason why you wouldn't want to spatchcock it? Just cut it in half is what you're doing. Why would you not want to do that? I mean, what's the disadvantage is you don't have that Norman Rockwell moment when you bring the whole turkey to the table.
Because it's all in pieces.
It's already in pieces. But in pieces is really, I think, a better way to cook a turkey, generally.
You're going to dissect it anyway once you get it there. I don't know how many people... if they still do that Norman Rockwell where they put the big turkey and they carve it at the table. The spatchcocking is probably, that would be the way I would prefer to do it. It's just a little easier to do, mm-hmm. and you don't have to, it takes some of the pain out of doing it.
Well, you've reinforced one of my thoughts, is that Norman Rockwell had done a disservice to humanity, right? And said that someone should commission a family portrait of a spatchcock. Cut turkey being enjoyed. Here's one of the things too that I've got to let the people know, is not only does Wanamaker's have all of the stuff, all the stuff that you want, but, and this kind of ties in exactly with it, is that there's a lot of that educational side of it too. You guys do classes, and of course Steve's available and the staff is available with a lot of answers on how best to use in order to get the results that you want. But for the during the holiday time, or at least coming up early part of 2020, which classes do you guys have that are coming up?
Well, we got two in January. One I'm really excited about. We're partnering with Greg and Christine Gardbo from Chicago Culinary Kitchen. We're going to do a barbecue and craft beer night. That's going to be on Thursday, January 23rd. And if you haven't been to one of their classes up at their place, up in Palatine, you get instruction, but you also, and I'm telling you, you're gonna eat more than you thought you could possibly eat and take some home. It's a fantastic class. They do a great job. Everything from sausage all the way up to brisket, and they kind of show you how they prepare it, how they make their food up there, and they pair it with a craft beer for each course.
Yeah, one of the things too is, if you're familiar with them, and we'll have links up at WGN Radio. .com as well, is that they really do put a lot of, it's a show, right? They put a lot of pizzazz, a lot of kind of showbiz into the food side of things. It's something not only to enjoy and to taste, but also to kind of see and experience as well. Steve, we're going to have to hold you on for a second. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to hear about some of the other classes. And then we're also going to hear a little bit about Operation Barbecue Relief. And I know that you guys support that in a big way. And so we'll hear how people can get in on that. So quick break. It's Dane here with you on 720 WGN. And we are back, and on the line with us, we're going to bring him back in. We've got Steve Cross. He is the department director, manager for Wanamaker's out there in Downers Grove, and they have not only all the tools that you look for, all the equipment, but the spices and the rubs and all that, a lot of know-how on the classes side and on the advice and insight side as well. So Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Steve, what else do you got? So you mentioned that, and then so you have things that are seasonal oftentimes, right, just kind of addressing things that people are curious or interested in. But then also sometimes, for those people that are barbecue enthusiasts, like how to make a brisket and how to do it right, from teams that do that day in and day out, you guys have those kind of classes too sometimes.
We do. We have those are probably what the our next classes that are coming up in the spring will basically deal with the the main proteins of you know, any kind of competition or what, you know, people consider their favorites. You know, we do have the brisket class coming up on January 26th. And that's put on by my good friend Sean Young with Double O Drum, and that's a very unique class. It's, you know, it's 4.5 hours, very detailed on how you trim the briskets and all that other stuff. You do get to eat a lot of it, but you come home learning a lot and a full belly.
And so, Dave, you had a thought too, like on the, it's one thing on the brisket side, but also on the, was it brining, right? You were
Steve. We had brined for years, especially we got our heritage bird for Thanksgiving one year, and they said you should brine it, so we brined it, and it turned out pretty good. And we've brined it for several years after that, and sometimes it was great, and sometimes it was too mushy, the meat was, that is. And I think that's perhaps the result of over-brining. And incidentally, for those at home, brining, if you haven't done it, is basically you take like a pot of water, you put salt in there, brine, as the name suggests, usually some spices, some sugar, and then you let the bird or other meat, chicken, sit in there for a set number of hours, and that is supposed to make the meat more moist. Now, Steve, have you found that people are still I've heard some criticism of brining over the last year or so. People saying, "Ah, you don't have to brine; it doesn't do anything. Nobody knows what it does." How do you feel about brining?
You know, I usually do brine it, and I do find that it does make it a little more juicy, makes it a little more tender when you're done. I have found that a lot of people are still doing it. It is still very, very popular. At Thanksgiving, I sold, we moved a lot of the different brines, and it's still a very popular way to do it.
Good. Okay. Yeah, I guess it works. I think there's a problem though with, and I think the mistake we were making was over brining it, like maybe keeping it in the refrigerator overnight or for 18 hours or something like that, which is maybe too long for a brine.
I don't know. That doesn't sound too long, right? I mean,
they usually recommend an overnight.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would think so. Here's one thing we definitely want to touch on, especially at this holiday time, but you guys support it. We support it on a regular basis throughout the course of the years, Operation Barbecue Relief, and that's one of the things near and dear to so many people, certainly you, Steve, as well as one of the not only supporters of the organization, but also one of the volunteers as well. I know we've got some books there that were signed by Myron Mixon, that $10 from every one of those books is going to go for as a donation to Operation Barbecue Relief. But for the listeners that may not be familiar, take a couple minutes and explain what it is, what they do, and why it's so important.
Well, what they do, it's a great organization. It's completely all volunteer with people such as myself and just other barbecuers around the country. Basically, what they are is, they're a disaster relief. They're into mass feeding. They're there to kind of add a hand before, agencies such as FEMA or state governments or whatever can get themselves organized to where they can provide that service. And Barbecue Relief will go in and they're going to cook. You're not going to get a sandwich. You're not going to get a bag of chips and a bottle of water. I mean, you're going to get pulled pork. You're going to get pork tenderloin. So people are going to get that comfort food. When your life has been turned upside down by either a hurricane, tornado, flood, something like barbecue just brings it relaxes you, and it's that home cooked meal, and that's what their big thing is cooking that one meal that makes a difference. And it's a fantastic organization and completely volunteer. And it's just we just do a great job at making sure people get that one meal when they need it.
Yeah, the story behind the kind of the origin of it, and Stan Hayes, mutual friend to all of us and all that, is at Joplin, Missouri. Back in 2011, a tornado came through and pretty much decimated the town, and they were able to, on the barbecue side, one of the things about it, and Steve, you touched on it, is that it's a quintessential like comfort food. There's something kind of special about it as opposed to you know, like a ham sandwich, you know, that's wrapped up, that kind of, you know, gives people comfort, kind of sustains people, and gives them a little bit of I think, goodness in a time when there's so much that is upside down. Plus barbecue, just the nature of it. It's a very communal kind of group. You know, everybody around the country kind of knows each other, works together, and it's mobile. So you can
bring
you can bring it in a trailer, and you can cook, and you can feed masses of people. And so when it comes to whether it's the, you know, tornadoes, whether it's hurricanes, whether it's forest fires, I know that they were down there. Steve Wright, correct me too. I know I saw some of the social media with the Bahamas with that huge thing there. Even in a remote place like that, they mobilized and got in there.
Yeah, they did. It was actually their first international deployment, I guess they call it. You know, they basically stationed in they were at an airport in Fort Lauderdale, and they had a church had donated the use of this World War II cargo plane. Was actually pretty neat, and I can't remember the name of the plane. I'm sorry about that. But what they were doing is they were making the meals and loading it onto this plane and then actually flying it into the Bahamas to help feed those people this year that were, you know, decimated by that hurricane that practically just wiped out the whole island.
Yeah, we'll have links up at WGNradio.com. And mentioning, too, is if you get out to Wanamaker's and you're looking for some of those Christmas presents, is you've got those Myron's latest New York Times bestseller, BBQNA. If you pick that up, $10 from that book purchase goes to OBR. And so get out there and see Steve. So, Steve, before we let you go, give the location where you're at, website, the address where people come out, see you in person, and start picking some stuff out.
You can come and see us. We're at 1940 Ogden Avenue in Downers Grove. And online, we're at Wanamakers.com.
All right. Thanks, Steve. We'll let you get back to it. Thanks for staying up a little later and jumping on the show tonight.
Thanks, Steve.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. So for you, Dave, like, what is it? Now, you know, Carolyn, she's probably resting right now. She's probably got a good book out. Maybe she's watching.
She said she's going to be listening in.
She's binge-watching Murder, She Wrote, maybe. Who knows, right?
The Crown, sir.
What is a good gift? Because now for us, like, we're kind of at a tweener with the kids. You don't want to get them. They're not really into toys anymore. You don't necessarily want to get them even more electronics. And we've talked in the past on different shows and segments on the experience side. Those are always great. But for you, like, what do you think of as a, would you want as a gift?
My dad, who passed away about 3 years ago, had a rule for the last 10 or 15 years of his life, which is, don't ever get me anything as a gift that I can't eat. And I was like, I like that. I will follow that rule. And that's kind of what I followed, not only for myself, but for my family. I mean, I think that you never know whether they're going to... I mean, buying for women... I have three daughters, and my wife, buying for them is virtually impossible for clothing.
Thank goodness for, like, the gift card, right?
So, well, and gift cards always seem, like, too easy somehow, too impersonal. So what I did when I was in France is I got the kids a bunch of exotic sardines.
What?
Yeah, exotic... Well, at the conservas, you know, you're familiar?
Okay, sure.
They're like these Portuguese seafood, and... according to Donny Alejandro at the new Porto Portuguese restaurant, in conservas they use the very best fish. I mean, they're selecting out the best, they're canning it, and then they're shipping it around the world. They're called conservas, conserved fish, saved fish. So I got a bunch of sardines at this cool little Parisian épicerie and some fleur de sel, which is like a fancy type of salt. I figured this is stuff they will use. And
I mean, the exotic works. You got me there. But then sardines is the word that...
I know. And I think it's kind of funny, too. I mean, years from now, when I'm long gone, my kids will think back to that joyous Christmas when they opened up
sardines.
Their gifts, and it's sardines from Dad.
Well, fortunately, sardines are not necessarily considered to be a Chicago delicacy. When we come back from this break, we're going to continue that conversation. We're going to talk a little bit about Da Best Fest. I'm going to have Seth in studio with us on Monday, but we'll talk about Chicago foods you know and love, maybe some you're not aware of. Keep it here.
Definitely.
720 WGN. WGN, it is Dane here with you in the Skyline Studio, high atop Chicago on on a Friday night. And Friday night is the kind of night when you, well, typically growing up, that you would have your pizza, you'd have your kind of delicacies, right? You're not going to just have like mundane regular food. It's kind of the fun foods,
right,
that have become those staples of Chicago. And I was excited to hear and see some of the social media from our mutual great friend Seth Zurer, the originator, the creator of the phenomenon that is Bacon Fest, mm-hmm. Chicago. And you think, you know, it's like Molly Hatchet, right? You know, you've got one hit, and you've got to come up with something else, or maybe Foghat, right? So you wonder, like, just what are you going to give us something else? A few years ago, he came up with Dumpling Fest rappers.
Which was fantastic.
I thought it was great.
Combination of a dumpling festival and rap music.
Yes, and Rapper's hip-hop, Delight, right? With the WR, of course. You know, there's great cocktails there, and he has so many great friends in the food community that it's, I don't say it's easy, but he does put on amazing events. And so you're always looking for what he's going to do to kind of, you know, do something a little bit different. Bacon Fest is certainly dialed in. So he came up with Da Best Fest. So DA, kind of that Chicago,
duh.
Yeah, right, lingo thing, Da Best Fest. And the idea is, it is whether it's authentic takes on Chicago favorites, or whether it's kind of a little bit of you know, artistic latitude and elevation on the culinary and chef side of some of those things. I'm excited about it.
Well, I had an Italian beef with Seth this afternoon, and he said what he's looking for is people who are going to do some of the traditional dishes, and then people who are also going to do like a spruced up version, a chefy take on a classic. We talked about the mother-in-law before the break. He's got a guy,
chefy take,
Oliver Poilievre at Le Bouchon in Chicago, a French restaurant, and he's doing a mother-in-law, which, as I said, is like a tamale in a bun with chili on top, dressed like a hot dog. Sounds weird as hell. Offered at Fat Johnny's on the South Side. What this guy from Le Bouchon is going to do is a mother-in-law with duck tamales, duck chili, a crispy duck skin, which could be fantastic. Sounds to me, though, like a different thing,
yeah.
But also delicious. So Seth is going to try to get his idea at this point is to get a regular, like the authentic version, and also then a higher-end take on the same thing, which should be interesting.
It's a gift that he has, and it's something that we mention all the time when we talk about Bacon Fest, is that you'll have, you know, just street food ma-and-pa places, and then you'll have some of the top fine dining places all in one place, all in the same event, all cooking together, all right there shoulder to shoulder. And so that's neat that he's doing that. So when you think about this, and to let the listeners know, Dave Hammond, of course, dining and drinking editor for New City, and as he mentioned a little bit earlier in the program, working with Monica Ang from WBEZ and a bunch of things on kind of honing in on these indigenous kind of Chicago classics and foods.
Some of which we're well aware of, pizza, Italian beef, Chicago hot dog. Some of which, like the mother-in-law, perhaps a little less well-known.
Yeah, and I don't know that the way that it's described, you know, and kind of with the word crabby thrown in there somewhere, is I don't know that I would be, you know, wanting to go ahead and try it out. If I grew up with it, maybe, but the shrimp Dijon is something, I have not had it in years, but it is something when I hear it, I want it.
And it's a Chicago food.
And I absolutely love it. So talk a little bit about the origins of it. I was not aware at first, you know, I am now, that it wasn't something that was everywhere.
It was originated on Monroe at Dijon's Hotel and Restaurant. This is like in the late 19th century, 1890s. Guy just started making it, you know, had some shrimp, breadcrumbs,
and a truckload of garlic.
Butter. Yeah, and garlic, cooked it up, and it became kind of a favorite everywhere. So you'll see shrimp Dijon all over the United States. I'm not sure I can say all over the planet, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if it's served in some other countries, because it's such a natural. Chicken Vesuvio, another dish, originated at Vesuvio's restaurant in Chicago. Extraordinarily simple. It's chicken with lemon and wedge potatoes kind of baked together. There's, again, garlic in there. Nothing hot, though. I mean, the name Vesuvio, I remember the first time I ordered a chicken Vesuvio, it's like, man, this isn't, like, spicy at all. I was expecting chili, like Mount Vesuvius, right?
Right.
But it was named after this guy, Vesuvio, who opened Vesuvio's restaurant. Has nothing to do with the heat level in the food. So some of the foods that maybe people haven't heard of. Now, related to the mother-in-law is the tamale boat, which I had at Parkey's on Harlem in Oak Park. It was so good, I went there 2 days in a row. I had it one day. It was so good. I went back to the next day.
That's high praise.
But it's so simple. It's a cup of chili with a Chicago corn roll tamale dropped into it, onions on top, sport peppers. But what made the difference, what made it so good, was the chili. And I asked the lady at Parkey's on Harlem, I said, that was really good chili. And she was so proud. She said, yeah, well, I'm from Texas. I brought this chili. This is my family recipe. So they actually make their own chili there, which is a huge plus for a quick service joint. Dropped the tamale in there. As I say, I went back the next day. It was so good. I brought my brother back.
Hey, look at this.
Yeah, we're eating this tamale boat and just loving it. A guy, an older guy, just makes an order. I didn't know what he bought. At the window, he walks away. He trips. He falls into a glass window, what? Shattering the glass window. The guy's laying on the ground. We're like, holy! We go over there. They call 911. We're helping the guy up. The emergency medical team is there, like, instantaneously. The guy's not injured. We, you know, help him get ambulance, boom, boom. Go back to eating the tamale boat. Appetite unfazed. That good. I'm not going to let a little thing like a personal tragedy get in the way of me.
No way. Get your priorities lined up. Well, here's one of the things, too, that Kevin Hickey, you know him. I remember him back when he was at Alley in the Four Seasons, and he's been at some things with Rocket Ranch, and then, of course, the Duck Inn. And he has been one of the times where I was, emceeing Chicago Gourmet, was him taking kind of an elevated take on his Chicago hot dog, but he does his famous duck dog. And I think at Time Out, he is doing an elevated take on the beef sandwich. You know, so he's taking another Chicago situation and kind of elevating it on the beef side. Is that one of the things that, because what can you do? There are certain things about its kind of pristine simplicity and the tradition that I don't know if you just use better cuts of meat if it's going to be any better. It's kind of satisfying the way it is.
I think different cuts of meat, and a lot of beef places have their own spice recipes. Like an Al's Beef will have a different juice than you'll find at Johnny's or at Buona or Mr. Beef, wherever. So there are ways you can tweak it, still remaining within the parameters of the traditional Italian beef.
And then the go-to when you're going to elevate anything, whether it's a burger or whatever, you got the brioche bun. Just won't work, right? Because it's got to have the certain tolerance for moisture.
Absolutely. And I heard of somebody who was serving Italian beef on a croissant, and it's like, oh, give me a break. I mean, how are you going to have that wet, which is how I prefer to have it. I mean, dip the whole damn thing into the jus. I mean, a croissant is going to, like,
you'll fall apart.
Exactly.
It's going to be paste.
You'll have to have it dry. Which is, who wants that?
Who wants that? So we've got maybe a minute before we have to get to break. What other things are they going to look at Dubest? Because you got a little bird dog recon situation.
I'm pretty
with
sure they're going to do Rico Bene's breaded steak sandwich.
Okay.
He has soured a generation of Chicago diners. Not he. A generation of Chicago diners have been soured on Rico Bene's because of a post on Chowhound in 2004 by the OG of Chicago Thai food, Eric Hill, who said about Rico Bene's steak sandwich, there were times when I was eating it when I was absolutely convinced I was chewing on wet carpet padding. And if you ask people like Wiviot or other, Gebert, guys who have been around Chicago food for a long time, ask them what they think of Rico Bene's. They're going to say, oh, I don't like it very much. Then ask them, do you remember what Eric M. said about that? They, to a person, will say yes, because it was such a catchy put down.
Well, in my mind, I'm imagining the carpet.
I like it. No, I will say, I like his breaded steak sandwich. I think it's delicious. It's basically a pounded steak, breaded. Fried. It's like a chicken fried steak with marinara.
We talk about road trips typically and on a regular basis, and this is the kind of thing you can do. You can get your Chicago delicacy, you can get it in the car, go 3 hours to the south instead of going to that neighborhood where they've synced up the music to their Christmas decorations. You can go to Indianapolis Motor Speedway and check that out. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk with President Doug Bowles, president of Indianapolis Motor Speedway, about a way to experience the Speedway and lights and all the festivities that are happening. So keep it here. When we come back, it's Dane on 720 WGN. 720 WGN live high atop Chicago in the Skyline studio. And people often think of spring and summer for Indianapolis Motor Speedway for iconic events like the incomparable Indy 500, the Brickyard 400, as well as all sorts of concerts, festivals, events. But IMS is a year-round destination and a perfect place to blend holiday spirit with speed. And on the line, we have the man behind so much of the fast and fun at Indy, the president of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, J. Douglas Bowles. Doug, welcome to WGN.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's always great to have you on because you always have great things for the listeners to see and do and opportunities to get down there and experience some Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And so this is something that we've talked about in the past a bit, an opportunity to get out there on the Speedway whenever you can do that. That's exciting. But you've got some cool new experiences built into everything this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is our fourth year of having lights at the Brickyard, which essentially is we turn the racetrack into a drive-through 3.2 million light festival. And it's been a lot of fun to have people in the facility in November and December. And this year, the first week in January even, that we haven't, you know, normally we're shut down because it's winter. So it's a lot of fun. And this year, for the first time, we're actually doing an out-of-car experience through Christmas Eve. People can come, drive through the lights, but then park, hang out in Pagoda Plaza, which is our big building, you know, in the center of the racetrack, get a chance to go up in the Pagoda and overlook the lights from 100 feet above in the Pagoda. So it's a new experience for us, and we're pretty excited about it. And, you know, it's just kind of fun to have people coming through the gates of the Speedway at a time you just don't think about it.
You know, the Pagoda is really cool. And if you don't have some sort of official business there, a lot of times the fans don't get an opportunity to do that. So to do that and have it not only be an experience, I think, in and of itself, but also kind of double as that perfect vantage point to be able to see things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The neat part about it is it is hard to get access to because it's usually large sponsors and others that are in there during event time. So the general public just doesn't really have access to it. So having that access, getting to go to the eighth floor, which is, you know, like I said, 100 feet above the ground, you get to see their outside decks, and there's an inside area so you can stay warm and have some hot chocolate and adult beverages, and it's all decorated in holiday lights. So it's pretty exciting. I'm looking forward to having people experience something new at the Speedway as part of our Lights at the Brickyard.
From a road trip perspective, you know, we have people, and I'm not sure if you've ever done that, packed the family into the car, Doug, and headed out for maybe some neighborhood that seems to be, like, you know, active or doing it right on the decoration side. But this is a really great opportunity. So 3 million lights. You mentioned this is the fourth year, and I'm sure there's some things that are kind of cool, whether it's the logo and certainly some of the cars and some of the ways that you configure the lights that match up with everything going on at the track. But do you mix it up a little bit, like as far as some of the different displays and what people will see?
Yeah, so we've got, you know, over 500 displays and 40 different scenes, and we continue to add scenes every year. My favorite continues to be, though, the race cars, and the opportunity to drive down the front stretch of the Speedway and across the Yard of Bricks. You know, you could do that every year, and that's okay as far as I'm concerned. And most of our fans think that moment is the best moment of the evening out here. So it's really kind of cool. There's some things that are similar to last year, and they, like I said, we continue to add new stuff every year.
Well, let's talk about how people can get down there and get in there, because you have tried to make it. You mentioned the Pagoda as far as being accessible, but the whole situation, I think the thought process is to get people in there, give them the opportunity in quantity to be able to see and experience it. And so it's pretty reasonable. You get a whole car full of family, friends, or people you can tolerate. And what are the costs on that? How does that work?
So if you come down Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, it's $25 for a carload of folks, up to 15. So if you can get if you can get that many in your car, it's $25. And then Thursday through Sunday, it's $30 to just drive up to the gate, pick up your pick up your pass, and you get to wander through. So then once you get in, if you get into the venue, then you can just park your car out of car experience is part of that experience.
Now, do you ever have people kind of doing that whole clown car thing, or to where you or check the trunk? I mean, is there any, like the old movie theater thing?
Yeah, the problem with the trunk, you know, if your car's filled up enough that you got to put people in the trunk, they're not going to see much. So we haven't worried too much about the trunk. Although, you know, a lot of us longtime Indy 500 fans have stories of, you know, smuggling people in the gates for the 500 in the trunk to save the $10 or $15 of the gate admission. But we discourage that. And if you bring that many people and you were planning on putting somebody in the trunk, I'm sure we can figure out a way to keep you in the $25 range, not charge you for the over 15 price.
It's good to put people at a safety or moral crossroad, right? You know, you're going to help them.
Correct.
You're doing
absolutely
the people's work, Doug. And oftentimes with the events that happen in Indianapolis, you always have a higher purpose built into it. The experiences are one thing, and this year is something else that is new. And if you could share a little bit with the listeners, the Riley Children's Foundation partnership, where there's some good going along with all the good fun.
Yeah, so one of the relationships we've had at the Speedway really from the beginning of our days in 1909 is with Methodist Hospital, which has become IU Health, and part of the IU Health network is Riley Children's Hospital, which is Central Indiana's major children's hospital. And And we decided this year that if you go to ims.com/Riley and buy your Lights of the Brickyard tickets on that page, we'll actually give $10 to Riley's, and then you get $10 off of your price when you come through. And then if you come on Tuesday night and bring a toy that we can send down to the kids that unfortunately are going to be in the hospital over the holiday season, we'll give you a little discount at the gate as well. So we're trying to find a way to give back, and we've done stuff with the Boy Scouts in the past and some others, but we felt like it really made sense with the kids that are in the hospital as a way to try to give back to them in a holiday time that they don't get to spend at home.
That's awesome. I think that's such a great initiative to do that. We'll have links up for that at WGNradio.com. And this promotion you mentioned, and we'll kind of recap it again, it's been going on since early December. There's some cool things that are starting the middle of December, and now you guys are even going into January, which is an extension of what you guys would normally do.
Yeah, the last 3 years we've stopped on New Year's Eve, and then we've gotten a lot of feedback from fans that said, hey, you know, the kids are typically out of school that first week in January before they go back, and we're looking for things still to do, and we didn't get a chance to make it during the holiday season leading up to Christmas and New Year's because it was too busy, so we're leaving it open. It's really at the recommendation of the fans so they get an opportunity to come in. We actually opened a few days later this year, and we're staying open a few days longer, so we're open about the same number of days. We just adjusted the schedule to take advantage of that week when kids are out of school and that fans and customers have said they'd like us to be open.
What a cool way to be able to experience the Speedway, all of the things that go on there, get it, like I said, a little holiday spirit in with the Speed as well. When people think Indianapolis, invariably they'll think of the Indy 500, but we've talked about this on a number of occasions, the way that you have built in so many other cool events to make it more than just that amazing race day, but the week before, you got Fast Friday, and then on the concert side, it has proven to be a really successful and popular venue. And not only are you pairing the venue with all those great fans, but also great bands. I was excited to see coming up for the Indy 500 and all of the stuff that goes around with that. You've got REO Speedwagon. This is relatively new news that we're kind of breaking here. REO Speedwagon Sticks, they're going to be there for Carb Day.
Yeah, so music's become such a part of race weekend. And it started several years ago with Carb Day. And now Carb Day has really grown to be this big way to kick the race weekend off, and people come in and have a great time. So we're going to do REO and Styx on Friday, and then Saturday we've got the Luke Bryan concert here Saturday night. Our Snake Pit artists, who are the EDM artists who play on Sunday during the race in the Snake Pit. So we've got a lot of music that weekend, and pretty excited about Styx and REO. You sit and think of the number of songs, and even young folks will go, wow, I know that song, I know that one. So it's a great day just to come out and enjoy some racing, but also enjoy some music.
We'll have some of the information up at WGNradio.com for that, but the diversity is right there. You got the EDM stuff, you've got all of that classic rock, those iconic songs that everybody knows for the generations from Styx and REO, and then Luke Bryan. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than that, right? That's one of the biggest names out now.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about having Luke Bryan. And our Legends Day concert that Saturday before the 500 the last few years has been some amazing talent. We had Zach Brown last year. We had Jason Aldean, Keith Urban, just a whole bunch of the top artists come and play on that Saturday night. So getting Luke Bryan is a pretty big deal for us.
A pretty big deal, but kind of business as usual, the way that things have been going. That is awesome. Exciting stuff and great ways to build in not only your great family road trip down there to Indianapolis, so much to see and do there beyond the Speedway, but to be able to incorporate it even in the wintertime is awesome. Again, we'll have some links up at WGNradio.com and the place to get tickets for it. And you can get that and get the whole pass to get in there and bring a whole carload of people in there. It's IMS.com, I'm guessing, right, Doug?
Absolutely. IMS.com can get you everywhere you need to go, navigate through whatever kind of tickets or information you need related to the Speedway. Same on our social channels, but IMS.com is the place to kind of keep up with what's going on at the Speedway.
Yeah, well, great to talk to you. Great to have you share some of the things happening on the holiday side, and thanks for jumping on the show today.
All right, thank you.
720 WGN, it is Dane here with you. High atop Chicago Skyline Studio and riding shotgun with us, we have the one and only Dave Hammond, dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine, and who has done the deep dive into kind of the local delicacies and Chicago's foods. And there are, let's talk about some of the ones that exist here. And you have things like Lou Malnati's Pizza, right, that gets sent around the country, but typically it gets sent to people from Chicago who miss
right.
it, right?
Right.
They'll be in Florida or Arizona or some of those things. Are there things that are popular here that could really kind of, you know, gain a foothold in other places, or do you have to kind of grow up with it in order to appreciate it?
Well, some of the ones we mentioned, like the mother-in-law, tamale boat, and so on, probably are unique to this region and aren't going to travel far from there. The Polish, the Maxwell Street Polish, is something I'm pretty sure you can buy online. And even if you can't, it's easy enough to make wherever you are. And it's simple. It originated at Jim's Original, which used to be on the Maxwell in the Maxwell Street Market at Halsted, right at the corner of Halsted and Maxwell. And it's since moved over to Union. It's right along the Dan Ryan there. It's open. I think it's open. Yeah, it's open 24 hours a day. It's
all
open
the time.
Around the clock.
Yep.
It's for people who, you know, out partying a little bit on Friday night. They got a little. They want a little belly.
It's like the authentic Chicago like version of Denny's. Right?
Like, go or get, Waffle House or something like that.
Yeah, go get something real.
You can, and it's a pretty simple sandwich. The Jim Christopoulos is the owner, and it was his uncle or grandfather, Jim Stefanovich, who opened Jim's Original on Halsted, and now his grandson owns the place. And it's basically, it's pretty simple. There's a plaque on the wall saying, here's where the Chicago, the Maxwell Street Polish was invented. And it probably was because in the old days, like 30s and 40s, Maxwell Street was very close to the Union Stockyards. And in those days, being close to your source of meat was important. It what you couldn't, you know, there weren't, it wasn't like air travel and train travel bringing fresh meat to all these places.
Yeah.
So being close to the stockyards, getting that meat fresh, probably having it turned in the sausage right there, sent to Jim's Original, where it's cooked on the grill with a bunch of onions, the bun. It's basically the sausage in the bun with the onions, with mustard, boom, done. They also do a beef version, a kosher version.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more on some of those different foods throughout the course of the program. But as soon as we get back from news, we're going to talk movies with you, Dave Hammond, and also Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. So time for news, and we'll see you on the other side. That's Fast Talking, 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you, again, in the Skyline studio, high atop Chicago, and our celebrity hotline is going out to the worldwide recognized Hollywood of the Midwest, Peoria, Illinois, where we have the one and only, the man with his hand on the pulse of the entertainment world and the cinematic experiences as he shares them with us here on WGN tonight, the one and only Blockbuster, Blake Stubbs. Blake, welcome to the show.
Thanks, as always, Dane. It's been a short spurt since we last talked, but we got tons to talk about.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? These people making these movies and TV shows, you know, they just don't stop. You think you got caught up.
Oh, no.
And you just turn around, you get busy doing something else, arts and crafts or whatever, and boom, they made more.
Those Netflix series are killer. I'll never catch up.
No. So I know that pain, and especially when now we've got new streaming platforms that people are watching. You are never going to be without content.
True.
That's the easiest way to phrase it, I think, right now. If there's something you want to watch, it exists. And it used to be there were, what, 200 channels and nothing on? Well, now you can just really pick and choose what you want to watch and when you want to watch it. And that's a lot nicer, I think.
It is a lot nicer. That's
more convenient.
That's the consensus. Yeah. Well, we are going to get a little bit later on. We're going to be with you for a little bit here. And I know that people are excited about the new Star Wars movie. People are the consensus has been pretty great, pretty good, pretty interested, pretty all sorts of things. And people do come down. You got your purists on one side and you got people who like some versions on the other. The Mandalorian is something that we've been watching. So we'll talk about that as we get into kind of our Star Wars thing. But Dave Hammond is with us. And he is the dining and drinking editor for New City. And he had mentioned something that you and I had a text conversation about a couple weeks ago, which was The Irishman. And I think it's a testament to just how far that the streaming services have gone, where you have one of the most accomplished and respected directors. And you have some of these, I think just acclaimed actors that they decide to do something that's purely online. Right, that's purely a streaming situation with The Irishman. So, Dave, what was your thoughts when you got a chance to?
I was glad it was online because it's a long movie. Now, that's not a put down at all. I watched it in its entirety the first time, and I started watching it again immediately.
Isn't it 3+ hours?
It's like 3.5, I believe, isn't it?
3.5. It clocks in about 3.5. Yeah,
and it held me. I mean, I lived through that period of history too, the Hoffa murder and the Kennedy assassination and all that. So it was interesting to me from a historical perspective, even though it is a historical fiction, I guess. But and the acting was fantastic. Harvey Keitel, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, of course, and Joe Pesci. Some of them doing their tried and true roles. I mean, Joe Pesci, again, the mob guy, kind of crazy.
Yep.
De Niro, again, the mob. But, you know, I don't get tired of seeing them. I mean, that's kind of how they are now.
Now, Blake, and what has been kind of your impression of that and maybe some of the feedback that you've gotten from your fans and listeners and people who follow what it is that you say? Because there's been a little bit of that where... It's not broke, don't fix it. Obviously, they're kind of reprising sure. situations that they have been in before. They do it well. Obviously, they've won awards for it.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, but some people had come out and said, like, hey, you know, it's tough to kind of, it's just the same guys doing the same thing, you know, kind of situation.
Yeah, so I think the draw for this film, and the reason why I think it's been so talked about, is because of what they were able to accomplish with tech. And these old school, you know, actors, this collaboration, with the exception of Al Pacino, who had never worked with Scorsese, you know, in a film or making a film, you know, between De Niro and Keitel and Pacino and Scorsese, I believe you have over almost 50 years of collaboration there, or at least friendships. And then you start looking at how long they've been making movies together, and it's like, wow, this is sort of maybe made the swan song. You know, not that their friendship's over, but certainly this may be the final picture that we're able to align the stars and the director in this case. But to get Pacino involved, who, by the way, is one of the best performances of the year.
Mm-hmm.
His performance as Jimmy Hoffa is one that I think we're going to see a lot more talk come Oscar time. I wouldn't be surprised if he takes home the statue. It is one of my favorites of the year, on top of what I would call one of the finest performances of the year. So it's not just that it was really good. I also really enjoyed it, and I found it rich and a lot of times funny, because he's above and beyond the Call of Duty in terms of comedy, in some scenes. He's also very foul-mouthed, so I won't be quoting him at all, on the radio, but, if you're curious, you know, The Irishman's a 3.5-hour movie, so it asks a whole lot from its audience in terms of attention span. Because we're conditioned to like movies to be in that 90-minute to 2-hour sweet spot, and anything that goes beyond that is like a special event. You know, like an Avengers Endgame, which clocked close to 3 hours. You also had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, which came out in the summer. And that was 2 hours and I believe 41 minutes in the theatrical cut that was originally released. And that was another one of my favorite films of the year. Now, as far as The Irishman goes, I honestly don't think people are too over the idea of Scorsese and these guys doing this type of film. I would say it goes without saying they've probably made the best, you know, type of films. Now, that's not counting the Godfather films. Obviously, people have their attachment to those as well. They are incredibly fine films, the first two specifically. I'm not a huge fan of the third part, but I know that that might actually be the consensus among Godfather fans. So, you know, if you want to talk about, like, what makes this movie so special and why was it an online event and all these other things, now, I actually did get to see it in a theater. It had such a weird, scattered, limited release. It came actually to my hometown, which is not far away from Peoria, and they had it for, like, 4 or 5 days. So it was like if you had a chance to see it and you were willing, and you think you could sit still, you know, for that long, which I did. I survived the 3.5 hours before getting up out of my chair. I found it, you know, rich, engrossing. I think that, and granted, all of the story mostly takes place before I was born. You know, aside from the fact that that Frank Sheeran did live to be in his 80s and passed away in the early 2000s, and, you know, his deathbed confession led to the book I Heard You Paint Houses, which is what I believe it was De Niro and Scorsese had wanted to make a movie out of for years. In fact, it took him over 12 years to get the film made and released, and no one would give him the money for it.
Wow.
So Netflix was the only production only studio, the only presence that would help provide the financing because of how ambitious the project was going to be. And I think that tells you something. When Martin Scorsese, who is one of the all-time, I mean, he's probably the greatest living filmmaker. He's also, you know, a historian, a guy that has done so much to preserve film, to get film made by, in a lot of cases, women, people of color, et cetera. Like, he's kind of a beacon of good in the world of filmmaking. And people would not give him the money to make this movie. But Netflix did.
Well,
and that's sort of the interesting story element, I think, about how this movie exists and how we're able to see it.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about that. In the past, it may have been a compromise to do it this way, but now I think that there's ways to achieve all of the success and the accolades and the awards. I'm not sure about the finances. We'll talk with Blake about that when we come back from the break. But the streaming services, you know, the cachet is every bit there as it is in the, all those traditional avenues for distribution as well. So quick break. We'll come back. We've got Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. It is Dane here with you on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. We are back here. It is Dane here with you. And to my right, riding shotgun, is the one and only Dave Hammond. He is not only the dining and drinking editor for New City, but he is a world traveler, a Renaissance man, and also a film and movie enthusiast as well. We're talking with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, who's calling us from the recognized Midwest Hollywood, Peoria, Illinois. And Blake is back as well. And so when you talk about The Irishman, you think about this, you look at these, the actors that are involved that really can name their projects, and they haven't had to do anything they didn't want to do for the better part of like decades, right? Probably for 30 years or so. But then you look at the streaming thing, and you had mentioned it before we went to break. Well, Netflix, they agreed to like help them do this. And in the past, something like that would have seemed like a compromise, you know, where like, well, this is the best we could do. But now, you know, you're seeing, whether it was the Emmys or whether it's some of the consideration on the Oscar side, the stuff, the quality of entertainment and the participants on the acting side and every bit of it is just as good as anywhere else. Is that kind of what you feel, Blake, is that, you know, you don't have to have that traditional kind of apparatus built around it in order to make things that not only are great, but get attention as well?
Yeah, I think the big draw, too, because you just kind of touched on it there again with, you know, the talent and the people that are getting involved in making these films, or in many cases now also TV series style setups with different shows that either have short runs or long runs or multiple seasons or whatever. You know, Netflix is like a, I hate the phrase one-stop shop, but that's essentially what they're doing. You know, they're not only providing you the means to watch it, but they're also producing it, whether it be for a TV, you know, drop it, binge watch it type thing, or full-length films. And in the case of, you know, pairing with someone like Martin Scorsese or another movie that just came out on the platform, Six Underground, directed by Michael Bay, you know, directors, producers, actors, writers, et cetera, they're all able to, it seems, and I don't know the legalities of all their deals or what they've struck to make this content, you know, cause, and I say content because it's coming on an online platform. I need to get away from saying that. These are films and series. But it's almost as if they can come there, they can do one film, and they don't feel obligated that they have to do like a three-picture deal or a full series deal. Right. They can come, go, do a really creative project, get all the backing that they need. Netflix lets them have their vision, make things the way they want to do, which was a big thing for both Scorsese and De Niro when they were doing press. I kept seeing a similarity in responses they would have to other, to members of the media, which was, you know, Netflix came in, helped us either raise the money or gave us the money to make the movie the way we wanted to make it. And because it took us so long to do it, we realized we had to do all this digital de-aging. They understood and they backed that step of it. Whereas other studios and anyone else who had the money would have said, no, you know, take a hike. Like, we know who you are. We respect you. We love your work, but we just can't make this work. Like, that's just too expensive. And now, look, it's an estimation, but it's my understanding that this movie cost about $160 million to make.
Whoa.
So
now,
this was...
Blake, are they... So here's the thing. It's great to be able to do what you want to do, and I think these, all those participants that we mentioned, are the kind of people who, if they've got a passion project and they want to go ahead and do it, that they would do it. You know, it's like an actor that's successful that goes off and does an indie film because they really want to. Do we know, you know, Hollywood's always talking about, you know, what so-and-so got for a certain movie. Did they get, like, their, did Pacino get Pacino money for this, or did they all kind of take a pay cut just to do something they wanted?
I would imagine that the structure of the deals, and I don't, again, I don't know the specifics of anybody's payout in the end, but I would imagine that Netflix has a model that's been constructed that would pay them out similar to how back-end points would work on certain deals. And if you want an example of where that's come in handy, think back to Jack Nicholson as the Joker in Batman. He was paid a flat fee, but he had a considerable back-end point payout. And I believe, not that I can ask him right this minute, but I'm pretty sure Jack's still getting paid pretty well thanks to Batman, or at least made more money on Batman than he probably did most of the independent and other films that he's made over the years, just because of the structure of how his deal as an actor was built. And I would be willing to gamble that at some point, at least one to two of the actors in this film would have had a similar deal, which means they probably took a decent fee flat out, but in the end, they're probably going to get paid out over time, too, in perpetuity. And that might have been the upside of Netflix, keeping costs down. Like, that's probably why that $159 or $160 million I gave you is like an estimate, because they don't, you know, they might have been paid a little less, but they'll probably get paid over time. So that's kind of the upside, I think, for certain actors, especially actors of this caliber, actors of this prestige. The other thing is, a project like this, I don't know of another studio that would have been ready to tackle a 3.5-hour without making it a series, okay? Something like HBO might have done. But at the same time, like, Netflix just said, nah, take this money and go make your movie. And I think that's a big draw, especially for creatives out there, filmmakers, storytellers, actors. You know, if they could come in and not be tied down for 10 years, for example, and not to mesh lines with the Scorsese Marvel debate that apparently is still kind of got threads out there. But the idea of how, you know, like, Robert Downey Jr. signed on and was Tony Stark for 10 years.
Right.
I don't think actors really have similar deals to that with Netflix. I think they come, they make their project, and then they leave. And then, you know, the door is open. The bridge is still there. They'll still work together when projects come up, as opposed to, no, you're under our label for the next, you know, three pictures that you do. So I think Netflix is just bringing a different model that I think is just appealing to the artists in the filmmaking world, which is cool. You know, if it keeps bringing us quality films, stuff we can enjoy at home in the comfort of our own home and our home theater setups, and or on our phones, if that's how we choose to watch them, you know, all the better. I'm only paying $12.99 a month for it. So there you go.
it's just changed so much. And you look at just the amount of, and I think we're really, you know, as consumers and kind of the viewers, we're really in a good position where you mentioned the price structure, and then you look at, for Disney, they just put it on at $6.99 a month. And so you look at the amount of entertainment and content that you have access to, and it's really great. And it must be working for everybody, because you look at the level of production and the talent and everything. So they must be making plenty of money. It's kind of like the Wild West, right? Because they're going to have to sort of consolidate some of the content. You've looked at what Disney has done with, you know, not only their their kind of franchises, but also on the Marvel side and the Star Wars side. And, you know, when we come back from the news, or from the break we've got at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk a little bit about the Star Wars side of things. But is this – oh, go ahead, Dave.
I'm just curious. You had mentioned expense of The Irishman, and then you had kind of in the same breath talked about the de-aging process. Is that an expensive move to do? I mean, I know there's some serious – CGI, I guess, involved. But my question is that a costly strategy?
In this particular case, it is my understanding that it was costly. And it was costly because they were pushing the limits of this technology into new areas. I mean, there's a couple of pieces out that you can look up about the uncanny valley, which is the term that they're using when they de-age someone or they computer generated bring someone back to life, kind of like how they did with Star Wars Rogue One with Peter Cushing, and then they also in the same film de-aged Carrie Fisher's character and then had a stand-in, so she wasn't even there. I mean, it was her voice, but it wasn't her. It was an actress that they put her face on top of. This particular film, The Irishman, pushes this into levels of, by the time I was finished watching the movie, I kind of forgot it was even a part of it. Now, at the start, I noticed it, because obviously Robert De Niro looked considerably younger than Robert De Niro looks. And he looks good for his age. It's not to say he doesn't look good. It's just a matter of, they explained very clearly that they were going to de-age him by about 35 years.
And when you see
at one point.
Right. When you see the face, That's one thing. When you see the full body moving, it's another. And I'm sure you've read the criticism of the stomping that De Niro gives that Baker, whoever he is. And he's moving. He's moving like an old man. I mean, he's moving very stiff and kind of rigid.
Yeah.
And he doesn't look like a 30-year-old guy. I've seen that side by side with him in Goodfellas, where he's stomping the guy in the bar. It's different motions. Younger guys throw their arms out when they're applying a kick to the face.
It's actually probably of the criticisms that I saw for The Irishman, and I was very high on the film. That was also incredibly valid.
Yeah,
that one very much is. And there's a few other instances. I think that if you want to, it's a short, brief moment in a film, but it's.
Hey Blake,
go ahead.
Hold tight because we got sort of a strict break structure. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. Get into the Star Wars stuff at 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it is Dane here with you in the Skyline studio talking a little bit of movies, not only just the making of movies and what's out, and we're certainly going to get into some of those, but also kind of just that thought process and just the way that the whole landscape on the movie making and watching experience has changed, and we've seen things that were a compromise on the streaming side now get to be as appreciated and as highly thought of as maybe some of those traditional ways in the theater. On the line with us, calling us from Peoria, is the one and only Blockbuster, Blake Stubbs. And Blake, remember, I know he's been on with us a couple times when we've talked, but Brian Nugent, a friend of mine that works out in Hollywood, has been one of those special effects guys in so many different movies, whether it's the X-Men movies or the Guardians of the Galaxy and Lord of the Rings and all that kind of stuff, was part of that Oscar team that did The Curious Case of Benjamin Buttons. And that was one of the things that they did, not always in super high-profile ways, but even sometimes, even like I think they did the Sex and the City movie where they had to kind of de-age Sarah Jessica Parker or whatever, like just go in there and make her just freshen her up a little bit. You know, you weren't necessarily making Robert De Niro young again. And so that's something that's been around for a little while. I think that the uses for that are going to be expanding. David had wondered during the break is how expensive could that be? Is that something that you can really attach, I guess, a price tag or value to, especially as technology improves?
Well, and it's something that can work hand in hand with actual practicality. So my example for that is both The Irishman, because there are scenes you can actually watch a lot of the B-roll that they just shot, or B-roll of behind-the-scenes stuff that was done on the day, like when they were actually making the film. And De Niro's actually made up to look young, but then the de-aging is just digital correction. And there was another use of that in a film semi-recently, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. The opening of the film features a very young-looking Kurt Russell. And all that happened there was Kurt Russell's makeup artist, who had worked with him for over, I think, 35 or 40 years, had come in and said, well, I can make you look young, but it's not going to be perfect for the camera. And his personal makeup artist did a fine job, but then James Gunn and the crew ended up digitally kind of, you know, touching in or doing a little touch-up work on it, and it ended up looking pretty flawless in the movie. I mean, and a lot of it, as Kurt Russell pointed out in the press talking about the movie, is once they made me look young, I had to play young. I had to move different. I had to do all these things that I hadn't done in probably 25 years. I had to make it look like I was in my early 30s, if that. And it's like, well, he, I think, is a perfect example of this working very well. He inhabits it very well. And, of course, that's just like the first 5-10 minutes of the movie. So it's not like they're going to ride that out, you know, for 2 hours. But in the case of The Irishman, it kind of comes and goes. And you do see a much older Robert De Niro. In fact, I think they age him older.
I think so.
Several points. Yeah. So I think it's something, as far as cost goes, it's going to be on a film-by-film basis. I think what they need to do is stick to pairing it with excellent makeup. And if they're able to do that, it looks less chintzy, I think would be the word I would use. Like, it's so noticeable at times. And if you go back 10 years, okay, just 10 years, where this technology was used in Tron Legacy to de-age Jeff Bridges to his much younger Tron-aged self, it doesn't hold up. Now, is that movie enjoyable? Yes, I do enjoy that film. In fact, it was one of the first things I watched on Disney+. And I was kind of marveling at how, like, wow, 10 years ago we thought this de-aging was pretty good. It really doesn't hold up very well. It looks really cartoony. But then when you flip over and watch something like The Irishman, you're like, wait a minute. These guys are 76 and 78 years old, and they're making them look like they're in their 40s. That's pretty good, and it looks pretty solid. Now, is it perfect? No. But the more you watch the film, you just forget that it's even happening. And I think that that was intentional. And to be very fair to the film, watching it at home on my television, which I have done, versus when I saw it in a theater, there is a difference. It would have been better for everyone to see this in a theater. But unfortunately, this film was, there was a big contentious, for several weeks, there was a big contentious argument going on between Netflix and the exhibitors. Specifically, I think it was AMC theaters. Netflix and AMC could not come to an agreement on a wide release for this film. So then they ended up doing several things, like just showing it in specific exhibitors for short spurts. Major cities got it, so Chicago had it for quite a while. There were three screens at one point congruently showing it in Chicago, but none of them were in AMC theater. And then in New York, they actually converted the Belasco Theater, which is a Broadway theater that I saw Bryan Cranston do Network in April. They converted it to show The Irishman, and people were paying up to $97 a ticket to see it and sit in the orchestra.
Whoa.
So, I mean, you're looking at, for movies like this, which, you know, I classify as an event film, not like I would Avengers Endgame, but that was also very much a big event film. Special arrangements should and could be made, I think, in these cases. This is a film that I think it was very ambitious from a technical standpoint. I think it was very ambitious from a length standpoint. The storytelling, I think, is excellent. I think the acting is excellent. I think the editing, if this movie's not nominated for an editing Oscar, I would be very surprised. Thelma Shoemaker is a longtime collaborator with Martin Scorsese. If you surf around film Twitter, you're going to find that she's regarded highly as the queen. She is probably the finest editor, one of the top editors of all time. And I hope she is very much in consideration and just heaps on the awards on her mantle this year for this film. She did an excellent job. So, I mean, this is a special case. I think that we had a lot of good movies come out this year. This was unique in that it really hit its audience at home as opposed to in a theater.
Right, because you think of it, and this will be the last on this, because I know we got to get into some of the Star Wars stuff that people are waiting for. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's got everything about it is blockbuster in the theater, major release and everything. And so for them to be able to do it in the way that they wanted to, in the length of the movie and all that, and then keep it just on Netflix is pretty... is different, right? I think it's kind of brave,
right?
And kind of ambitious. And by most accounts, it was a successful thing. So you talk about the aging thing. We brought it up a little bit, whether it's Carrie Fisher or whether it's some of the other ones. What, you got something, Dave?
Oh, yeah. Well, this was, you mentioned the event nature of The Irishman, and I was going to transition into Star Wars. I remember when Star Wars came out, I was... I don't know, in my early 20s, something like that. And they charged an unusual amount for admission to the first Star Wars movie. It was probably like $2 or $3 more than the regular movie price, kind of calling attention to itself as an event, that this was going to be a big deal. And I remember sitting in the movie theater when I don't know the name, Star Cruiser maybe, when it comes down from the top of the screen, the audience let out a collective gasp that was so like, we have not seen this before.
Right?
This is worth the extra $2 or whatever. And then when they go to Lightspeed, I mean, those two points were like the audience was like, woo, this is a new thing.
Well, they had done things in ways that you had not seen before, that even the noises, you know, I remember seeing one of those documentaries about the making of it, you know, just the noise of the blasters, you know, how they were like hitting like telephone wire, like just the way that they were able to create things that hadn't been seen or done before or in that way. You mentioned the just the de-aging that they're doing in some of this, and then also kind of the foray into the streaming with The Mandalorian. They've done a great job. I don't know if you guys have noticed it, but when it comes to like the Wookiees and Chewbacca, the de-aging has worked great. I think that
they look a day older than the first time we saw him.
He looks great, and the Yodas are getting younger and younger by the minute. But so without any kind of spoiler alert, if you want to get into a little bit of the, well, actually before that, we'll use that in the last segment. We'll talk about the new feature film that's out, but your thoughts on The Mandalorian, because this is something where, and I think Star Wars fans have a lot of different ways to consume and enjoy kind of that product, whether it's just all those movies that jump around from era to era. You've got theme parks, you've got all that kind of stuff. And I thought this was a really cool kind of way to have bite-sized stuff that's very entertaining, very well received, and that's right there on that new Disney Plus.
Well, one of the things about The Mandalorian that jumps out for me, and this is more of a personal thing than a critic standpoint or a critical viewpoint, is I love samurai and Western storytelling. There's a big overlap of that throughout the history of filmmaking, from John Ford to Kurosawa and back, and it just what made Star Wars, because there's key sequences that are taken from A New Hope that George Lucas borrowed from The Searchers, for example, are a lot of that style is present in The Mandalorian. I mean, he's very much like a Ronin samurai who is sort of, you know, roaming and doing what good he feels he can do if it calls for it. And at the same time, you've got the comedy elements that work very well, especially with, I think, everyone's new favorite thing, Baby Yoda. We don't have the actual name of the character yet, but Baby Yoda is what we're calling him. And at the same time, every week seems different. It's not like your typical show right now, where I feel we've become so engrossed in long, drawn-out arcs, whereas there's clearly something going on in The Mandalorian, but it's not full focus. It's more like, where are they going this week? What are they doing this week? Every episode has been a little bit different than the last one. And, you know, there's a few threads that keep them all linked. This week's episode that they released Wednesday, so the day before Rise of Skywalker was released, not only did it have a few little details that sort of make an appearance in Rise of Skywalker, nice planning on Disney's part, but also, and it's subtle, it's not anything overt, I'm just saying if you pay close attention, you're like, oh, wait a minute, that appeared in the other thing. It's cool. It's a good reveal. And, you know, that, it's hard to make an audience, as Dave pointed out, gasp like that first time the Star Destroyer flew on screen while it was chasing the Tantive IV. Like, there's things like that that are just so unique, and when you can get that, you got to grab it, and you got to run with it, and you got to find a new way to make it happen again. And I think The Mandalorian is able to be both fun, engaging. It's this type of storytelling that we weren't really getting every week on television. And at the same time, it borrows from all these cool, very, very rich storytelling elements that, you know, in a universe, a Star Wars universe, which we're all very familiar with and very fond of, they've built interesting enough characters to kind of see where this goes. Now, long term, I hope that this show is able to pick up in season two and really have some strong foundations, maybe some long drawn out arcs, etc. But we'll see what happens. But by and large, I'm happy every week I watch it. So I'll put it there. Yeah, at that.
It is.
I'm a big fan.
But it is cool. You've got this sort of space age based thing. It brings up the samurai stuff. You've got a little bit of the Clint Eastwood spaghetti western kind of feel to it. As well, and with Jon Favreau there, you've got what is we've always said is kind of like the secret, you know, kind of sauce when it comes to Marvel, is humor. There's a little bit of humor based in it as well. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the brand new movie that's out there, what people are saying, without, you know, spoiling any of it. I know there's a bunch of cliffhangers. I've heard there's some things to either avoid or not know about, and we're going to hear about that.
Right.
We've got Dave Hammond with us, and of course on the phone with Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. Quick break. We'll be back. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you for another handful of minutes, but I am not alone. To my right, riding shotgun, is Dave Hammond.
Hello.
From New City, and then on the left from the recognized Hollywood of the Midwest, the one in like Blockbuster, Blake Stubbs. And we're talking about, it isn't every day, although it seems like there is oftentimes great movies to talk about and kind of break down, but it's not every day that a brand new Star Wars movie has come out, and one that includes, really, when it comes to, you know, characters in one of the most revered and beloved franchises in all of film is Luke Skywalker. So it's The Rise of Skywalker. And so your thoughts, I mean, is there a bar, Blake Stubbs, that you have that it has to be a certain way? Are you one of those purists, one of those like critics, or do you feel that like anything in there is kind of pure entertainment and you love any of these movies when they come out?
I'm going to put the fan hat on and respond to that question by simply saying I have always loved and adored the original trilogy. I have not always loved and adored the prequel films. I have been okay with the Disney films. So I hope that sets the table for a discussion about my thoughts on The Rise of Skywalker. I felt after we got that first film, The Force Awakens, that, you know, Disney was going to do fine by this. It was going to be enjoyable. Like, hey, if they take a run at trying to make a better film than Empire Strikes Back, I'm all for it, but I doubt it'll happen. I'm going to say, after all is said and done, it didn't happen. Because we're now at 9 and they're done, allegedly. But this is an interesting film in that I feel like they were so gung-ho to make sure that if this is the final installment of the Skywalker saga, and I'm not spoiling anything, that's their marketing, that's what they've said it's going to be, they wanted it to be a love letter to Star Wars. So the fans were going to get what the fans had wanted. And the big thing you have to take away from that is knowing, going into this, that a lot of people were very divisive on, or saw The Last Jedi as being a divisive film. I personally felt that it was going to push things in bold new directions. I was interested. I'm like, okay, cool, where are they going to go with this? In the case of The Rise of Skywalker, they don't really go very far with it. They kind of actually digress and get back to brass tacks and Star Wars and sort of shove fan service in your face. So if you're looking for cool cameos, fist-pumping moments, you're going to get them. They are in this film. I think and I'm not going to spoil anything about who or where or what. I'm just, keep your eyes peeled, because there are some blink-and-miss cameo moments that are worth your joy. And at the same time, I think when I mentioned it's kind of like a love letter to Star Wars, a lot of diehard Star Wars fans are going to see it that way. But I think that just as there are optimists and pessimists, but they can be diehards equally, I think that you could also argue that this film's a bit of a mess. It runs at a breakneck speed, which some might like, some might hate. It's action sequence after action sequence, and some of them are outstanding. But maybe that's not exactly what you want. You might want a little more meat in terms of exposition and story and lore and characters. But at the same time, I would just say, if you want to say it's one or the other, I think that's not the case. I think it's a bit of both. I think it is as much a love letter to Star Wars as it is kind of a bit of a mess, because it tries to bite off a bit more than it can chew. I do think that all the performances in the film are good. Especially, I want to give a shout-out to Anthony Daniels. This is his 9th appearance as C-3PO. He is, I believe, the only actor in the entire franchise to have been in every one of the episodes of the Skywalker saga. He gives an outstanding performance in this. And, you know, it is emotional. There are some emotional moments with characters we know and love. And you've probably been hearing rumblings. Just try to keep an open mind when you go in. I honestly don't think it's high up in the ranks for me, but it's definitely not at the bottom. It's probably more in the middle, I think, in the end. So I did enjoy it, but at the same time, that's the fan talking. As a film, I think it tries to do a bit too much. It runs a little too quick in certain places, and at the same time, it sort of trips over things. It tries to also disregard things that happened in The Last Jedi, and I'm like, why are you doing this? Like, I thought that we had these bold moves. They didn't really want to stick to those. They wanted to sort of bring it back around, recircle the wagons, and give the fans, I think, what they had really wanted.
Blake, your thoughts on... And it just kind of dovetails a little bit with sort of like the favorite foods and the things that you just love because you grew up with them kind of thing. Is like, what is it about? You know, they have tried whether it's, you know, jumping around from era to era and putting out their new, you know, characters and in every different, you know, good guys, bad guys, you know, animals, robots, you know, you name it, even making in so much as like building into the Star Wars land at Disney World is not going back to the, you know, the original with the, you know, the Darth Vader and the Luke Skywalker. And as far as the kind of worlds that they're building, what is it about those characters that make them, almost incomparable when it comes to they try to come out and bring new things up? But people are always gravitating back towards those originals. Is it just because we grew up with them and there's this sort of love affair with the originals, or is it that they just haven't been able to kind of crack that code and replicate whatever that secret sauce is that made them so great?
I would argue that part of it is when these characters hit the big screen for the first time, audiences were still susceptible to giving films a great suspension of disbelief, much like you would give live theater. I think now we live in a time where when you go in, trailers have inundated you with clips, and you kind of think you already have a breakdown of what's going to happen in a film, and then maybe the film surprises you, and that's about all the film might be able to ask you for. You know, you as an audience member, are you willing to be surprised? Whereas back then it was like everything was fresh. I mean, look, I was born in 1985. So while I grew up on the original films, and I say that, I didn't actually get to see them in a theater. However, I do know that the, and this is not a spoiler alert for The Empire Strikes Back, but the reveal of Vader telling Luke that he was his father was known as one of, and I was told this, was known as one of the greatest cliffhangers audiences had seen ever in film. And at the time that these films came out, and maybe Dave can comment because he said he was in his 20s when he saw this, was that a big deal for you as an audience member?
Yeah, I would say it was a big deal. And what was the exact line that Darth Vader said? Because I've heard different takes on what that was. He said,
"It's not."
Yeah, go ahead.
It's not Luke, I am your father. It's no, I am your father.
No,
the line
I am your
he
father.
Says. No, I am your father. Yeah,
I remember.
So because,
yeah, it had a lot of impact. Sure,
it did. Yeah, and I know that the sheer visual effects of what these films brought at the time that they were made was far and away better than anything else out there. So I think that the visual element, you know, really helps people connect with these characters. Plus, it's also fairy tale storytelling. Mm-hmm. Set in like a sci-fi backdrop, and that was kind of a neat clash of different types of genre of storytelling. So I think it's just one of those things where I don't want to call it lightning in a jar, all right, but clearly there was something there that made it click and stick for multiple generations.
You know,
now
I was just going to say another kind of mind-blowing aspect of the first Star Wars made a big impression at the time was how beat up the equipment was. That is like the that it was previous to that, you know, in movies like Forbidden Planet and so on, everything was like sparkling clean, like it was right out of the prop shop.
Yeah.
Right, the Millennium Falcon was like a beater.
Right, stuff looked like it had actually been used. And that lent a realism and a kind of wow, it's now feel to the whole first Star Wars experience I had in the 70s.
Well, now, Blake, we're on a tight schedule here as far as the breaks in the news, but we definitely, so in like 30 seconds, you want to say that you recommend it. If you're a fan of Star Wars, you're going to get what it is that you want, what you can appreciate, and it's something that people should definitely check out. It's an addition, although not mind-blowing, right? An adequate addition to the saga.
Yeah. It is an adequate end to this saga. I do want to just very bluntly say to people, enjoy talking about Star Wars again. There's been a lot of negativity around the fandom of Star Wars, what they've done to the cast members of this film, specifically Kelly Marie Tran. This is supposed to be enjoyable, entertaining, and fun. And there was one cameo in this film that hit my fun button, and I went back to enjoying Star Wars after I had all these like quibbles and issues and thinking about things, and I was like, wait a minute. And I'm not going to say what it was, but because it's personal to me, but when I saw that person in the film, I thought, whoa, okay, we're just going to have fun for the rest of this. And it made me kind of open up to the film a lot more. I think fans have to go see this film. I think people who aren't fans should see this film. Just make sure once you do, that you enjoy talking about it and don't argue or throw hate at each other or any of that, because I've just been seeing a lot of that lately, both on Twitter, socially. It's like, wait a minute, can't we just enjoy the thing? And you should be enjoying the thing.
Yep.
And so in this case, enjoy it. Have fun with it.
Entertaining and fun, as always. Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. As we let you go, the social media, people can continue the conversation with you. Where should they go?
They should find me on Twitter at Blake Stubbs. You can just chat with me directly there. Would love to talk about this. I'm just trying to not throw spoilers. I want people to have a couple of days to see it.
Yep. So. Thanks, Blake. Thanks for jumping on. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. And Dave Hammond to my right. Dave, if people want it, we only have like a few seconds, but if people want to follow you in New City and social media, where can they go?
NewCity.com, David Hammond on Facebook, DC Hammond on Instagram.
Want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks to everybody who participated in the program. We'll see you. I'll be in for John Williams on Monday, and we've got a lot of great stuff. Going to talk some great food. We do that quiz, that crazy quiz they do, and all sorts of cool stuff. And you can follow me on Twitter at Dane Tonomo.